outside, an apple or a grape could put forth a cloud of mercury. If run over by a car on a freeway in Los Angeles, once the spring has begun. It's a sport made from necessity. You're a portrait of your past. There's a mummy in the cabinet. Are there no more arrows left? What's that rubber bottle doing here? How's that napkin for a roof? 10 cents to a dollar now for a shelf of breaking heads. Robert Palmer is a floor.
Everybody, we are live. It feels,
Marco, you still have
I
a Tesla?
Like I do still have a Tesla. I was going to actually sell it over Christmas break, but I because my son got the flu and that kind of delayed it. Like we had to move all of our timing of all of our travel, and it made it so that there was no extra time that I was going to be spending around the Tesla to get it sold. So it didn't happen yet, but there are two more breaks coming later this winter. So we'll see. I got to sell it while it's still worth anything, because it's certainly worth a lot less now than it was last summer.
What
it's
is
Elon's
your
final middle finger to me. It's like, fine, you leave Twitter, I'm going to devalue your car.
So true. What is, if you're willing to discuss, what is your sale strategy for this? Are you Carvana-ing? Are you going to sell it privately? Because you're not looking to buy something, so a trade-in doesn't seem possible. Are you going to go to CarMax? Like, what's the plan?
So none of these things will give me a real quote. So here's it, when I was last home for like, you know, 2 days, I'm like, oh, let me try to sell the Tesla while I'm here, which was not enough time to, and I had way too much to do anyway. So I went, you know, I tried like Carvana and everything, and that none of them, they were all like, well, because of this not being a common car, you need to schedule an appointment and bring it in to us, la la la. And I was like, well, that's not gonna, you know, happen on Christmas Eve or whatever. So I'm like, all right, well, that's, I guess I'll do that some other time. And then I made a mistake. So I went to Kelley Blue Book to see, you know, what's my current, like, I figure, like, you're right, I'm not buying anything new, so that weakens my position for sure. But I'm like, you know, when you go to Kelley Blue Book, you get the three values. You get the dealer trade-in at the lowest, then you get the private sale, which is the highest, and then I forget what the middle one is. And I was like, all right, well, I'll take whatever, like, the lowest value, the dealer trade-in, I would take that. That's fine. Like, at least it would be out of my hands. I don't want to deal with a private sale. It's a pain in the butt. And it takes more time than, frankly, I ever have around. Like, I'm never there for long enough to do a private sale. Because right. I've done that in the past, and you got to, you know, you list it somewhere, and you got to wait maybe a week or two, and show different people the car, have them come around and kick the tires, and go on a little test drive, and then decide not to buy it. Like, it's a huge time suck. That's why I don't do that anymore. It's terrible. And I've never had a good experience with a private sale, and so I'm like, all right, as a seller, at least. As a buyer, I've had great experiences, but as a seller, I never had one. So I thought, okay, well, fine. I'll just, whatever the dealer trade-in price is, I'd be happy to take that. So I go on Kelley Blue Book and I deal the dealer trade-in price. And then they offer at the bottom of the screen, hey, get our like, you know, instant cash offer price now, and we'll buy the car from you without you buying a vehicle. You know, it's, so I thought, okay, let me see what they'll offer for that. And it's one of those stupid scams where they're not really actually, like, going to buy your car from you. They give your information to like 14 dealers in the region.
Oh,
and then
gross.
You get spammed like crazy from these desperate vultures, and they're all offering like $15,000 below the dealer trade-in value.
Boo.
So I'm like, okay, well, like, first of all, this is literally the site that just told me what my car was worth. And this is way below that. And second of all, now I'm going to get spammed forever from these rando, desperate used car dealers. Thanks a lot. You know, so I can't recommend Kelley Blue Book for anything at this moment, for either the valuation, which seems to be wrong, or for their stupid cash offer thing. So I'm probably going to go to Carvana or CarMax or whatever those things are, and take whatever they give me, which is probably going to be very, very low. And I'm going to really be grumbly about it for a while, but at least I won't have to, you know, deal with it anymore. So,
well, through the magic of YouTube advertising, I'm going to recommend something to you that maybe Casey will be familiar with.
Cars and Bids?
Exactly.
No, because here's the thing. Cars and Bids, I like browsing Cars and Bids to see, like, you know, what are the Rivians costing these days, you know? But but the reason I would not want to sell on a site like that is because that's a site that is browsed by car nerds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to sell my car to a car nerd.
But it's like eBay, though, like that. You just put pictures and then a bunch of people bid, and they're probably going to pay a lot because car nerds know what they're getting. Like, they understand the nuances of why this is good, low mileage, good condition, one owner, blah, blah, blah. And they understand this is the one before they ruin the steering wheel, so on and so forth. So you'll get a lot of money for it, and you don't have to deal with showing people the car and kicking the tires and if they like it. Someone's going to win the thing, and then they're going to buy the car, and they're a car person, so they'll probably understand what they're buying and know how to go and get it from you.
No. Cars and Biz is the kind of place where Casey should sell a car. Because Casey's cars have been detailed and washed and
Cars and Biz doesn't care that yours is a little scratched up. It'll be fine.
It's not going to be. No, car nerds, they're going to see things I've never seen. They're going to be the panel gap people.
But they also appreciate why your car is desirable above and beyond the fact that, you know, because all the like Carvana or whatever, all they care is like make, model, year, mileage, condition as a 1 to 5 scale. Like they don't understand the nuances of why this car is worth more than an uglier color or a model year that was worse. You know what I mean? Like I feel like you'd get way more money for there, and it should be just as little hassle because you don't have to deal with showing people the car and, you know, all that stuff. It's just you put up the pictures, people bid, you get a decent price, you sell.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the other thing too is like I also have and would want to sell with the car a second set of rims that had snow tires on them. Now the tires aren't usable anymore, so I'll probably have to dispose of those myself. But there's a second set of Tesla rims that, you know, that's probably worth.
The Cars and Bids people will also understand that those are valuable.
That is true, actually,
and be willing to buy them from you because they'll just resell them for more.
Right. So maybe, but then I gotta, like, first of all, you know, I'll have to do this not in the winter, you know, because it'll have to look nice. And
no, totally do it in the winter. I'm looking at a Ford Bronco right now. It's pictures of it in the snow.
No, but then I have to like go get it detailed, and like it's a much greater hassle.
You just gotta slum it on Cars and Bids. You're like, look, I've got a car. I know you want this car. Here's a bunch of pictures of it.
You've got bids. Let's make it.
That's right. Because you have a desirable car in good condition with low mileage. Like it's a slam dunk. Do not let Carvana buy this car for you for like 10 grand less than it's worth.
I also think I don't know. I've really soured on DeMiro over the years. I would also consider bring a trailer as a. I mean, it's not that different. It's a very similar thing.
Like eBay for cars is what we're saying. So you don't have to deal with lots of people looking at it.
All right. So for the bootleg, Marco's definitely going to cut this because it's going to be boring, but I want everyone to go on a journey with me. For the bootleg, I put a link in the chat. The bootleg, it's, I don't know what to tell you. Sorry, but it's a 1992 Nissan 350ZX twin turbo. Gentlemen, if you could click the hero image so you see, you know, the car, of course, it's white. Click to the right, you see the front view. Hold on, wait. No, I'm going somewhere with this. Then you click to the right, you get a side view. So keep going to picture number. Yeah. Hold on, I'm getting there. Hold on.
Is this your
4 of 101? Jeez.
Okay, no. Okay, go to picture
That's
number
the thing.
These 34.
These kind of sites, people want like 100 pictures of the car. I don't even know. I wouldn't even know how many to take. I'd be like, all right, here's one side. Who's like, I would take like 6 pictures. And be like, well, what else do you want to see? Like that. Like, how much more do you need?
It's fine. Okay, go to picture 34 on the
300ZX. That's not the stock shifter, right?
So, that's my question. This looks, for the most part, given it's a 30-year-old car, pretty clean.
Mm-hmm.
But would you, either of you, buy a car with that friggin' shifter on it?
I mean, it's so easy to replace. Just screw it and put the OEM on.
It isn't about that. It's about, would you buy a car that was driven by somebody who had the decision and taste to put that thing on it?
Exactly.
But they do have 101 pictures and you can look at it. And like you said, Casey, this looks pretty stock. Like, Everything else does.
But golly, that shifter makes me think this is terrible judgment.
Pretty good condition.
I agree. I mean, this looks
eerily similar.
There's
some staining on the door.
No, there's some aftermarket work here. Okay, it's all out. I'm done. There's aftermarket intercoolers. No, thank you.
Yeah, no, I see.
Weren't there giant fart pipes in the back? There's no way those are stock. Look at those fart pipes. There's not a chance that the stock ones are that big and shiny.
Whoops. How do I go back to the? Is there no gallery? There's an X
in the corner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's terrible because it's usually a quad exhaust, like, you know, two and two.
Yeah.
So where they're showing the paint thickness and stuff. These are people who are trying to get more money than their car is worth, right? Because this car is not worth probably what they're asking, but they're trying to say, hey, look, original paint.
I don't know. I agree with both of you, which is probably huge Casey energy. But I think that if you're going to do it, Marco, doing it on a eBay for cars is probably the best way to get the best price without too much work. But if you just want to be done and wipe your hands of it, I can sympathize with that. And I say, just go ahead and do whatever.
I think dealing with one of those companies is worse than dealing with someone who would buy on this website.
Yeah. I think these wheels are mounted backwards, actually. Those wheels were directional. And I think the long end on the front wheel, I think the rears are correct, I believe, and the fronts are wrong. Oh, that's all right. Moving on. Okay, bye, Future Marco. Thank you for indulging me. I needed to get that out of my system because, God, I missed my 300.
I should go on that side and look for a quartz.
I'm pretty sure you will not find a single one.
Oh, no, they're there. Of course they're there.
Oh, there are.
They're there.
Oh,
and,
oh my God. Look at this pile of shit that sold for $8,000. I put a link in the chat.
The first one, the 2000?
Yes. How did that fucking thing sell for $8,000?
Wow.
Did you see the, they also made, this is my,
I just recently learned about my car.
Yeah, I mean, this, I'm coming around to John's point of view now.
I just recently learned about the SIR series, which is mostly in Japan. They made a Honda Accord SIR. And it was called, actually, the Honda Accord SIRT, and it was this generation of Accord, and it had, like, a blacked-out front grille. It was also Japan-only.
It's not pronounced SIRT, it's SIRT, like serrated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that sold for, like, thousands of dollars. I think it was right-hand drive, too. Yeah, no, they're Accords.
Here's pretty much exactly my car with three times the mileage.
That's what I'm saying.
That sold for $10,000 more than what they offered
that's
me.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
John, I'm coming around to John's point on this one. I hate to break it to you.
That's a substantial difference.
You've got the things that your car has are intangibles, and you know those intangibles are only going to be appreciated by car people who know what they're getting.
What intangibles are you thinking of? Previously owned by Marco Arment?
It's single owner, good condition, low mileage, and it's the Model S before they screwed it up.
It's the last one with a goddamn sunroof.
Oh.
And a round steering wheel.
Yeah, and a complete steering wheel. You get the entire steering wheel with this price.
And it's just driven by a little old man in Westchester to church every Sunday. It's not like it was not flogged. It was not abused. He was not drag racing on the weekend.
Only hit by one plow.
Yeah, no teenager ever drove it. Its only accidents were like when it was parked unattended. Like it's just it's a good car. The battery's probably got tons of life left in it. Yeah. Check the battery health thing.
The stock tires are not that well worn because I kept snow tires on it for like a year and a half straight. Hasn't really been
and at this point you can be pretty sure it isn't one of those ones that's assembled with roofing screws, right? Because it would have fallen apart by now.
Yeah, right.
So whoever built this one was not like, you know, just slapping it together in a tent.
Oh, I guess I should probably do this, but this sold in Texas. I don't know.
That's the thing, you don't have to deal with that. They'll come and get it just there. The people who want this car are going to want it.
How does it work? They literally just like send a trailer to come get it or what?
Yeah.
I mean, whoever buys it is going to do that. If it's the buyer's problem, you say where you are and it's the buyer's problem how they're going to get it, but it's not your problem. You don't have to ship it to them.
I mean, you do have to.
Mine's in less crappy condition than this one.
See?
Look at this manual Accord. $30,000 for a stick shift Accord. Man, that's rough.
Put a link in the chat.
$30,000. This is like the last manual Accord. I think their prices are going up. It's white. Of course it's white.
It's not. I don't care. Is this one of yours or Tina's generation?
This is the generation after. This is not my favorite generation, but it is the final generation of the stick.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah.
going to be a thing for sure.
No, totally. I don't think I like the look of this one as much as I like the look of y'all's.
No,
like, Tina's
better.
In particular, I think is quite good looking if memory serves.
But this engine is better.
Fair enough. All right. Goodbye, future Marco. Thank you for indulging.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do some follow up. Jonas
what if
writes,
"Pay John like $5,000 to just come do this entire thing
just,
for me.
Just use it as packing material for some other thing you're going to send me. I'll take the Tesla off your hands.
I'll fill the Tesla with Kindles and send it to you.
Because as I enjoy stick shift cars, but if I'm going to have one without a stick shift, it'll be electric.
Amen to that, brother. Amen to that.
Yeah, you know it's better than manual transmission? No transmission.
There's still a transmission.
Not really. I mean, Tesla's a single speed.
I know, but it's still... Anyway, whatever.
Is it a transmission if it can't change gears?
Yeah, because it changes the gear ratio. It's not just like one-to-one.
No, I think it's... I don't think it does.
It does.
How?
Marco... Because it transmits power.
It is a
power.
Fixed ratio, but it is a gear ratio. There are different
That's
numbers
just
of
called
teeth
gears.
On the gears.
There's just a set of gears.
Right, but they don't all have the same number of teeth. The gear ratio is not one-to-one.
No, but
otherwise, your back wheels would be turning at 20,000 RPM.
No, I know. But I don't think, like, do Teslas have more than one gear besides forward and reverse?
No, I mean, like, actual gears as in circular things with teeth that mesh with each other. Go look at exploded diagram of the thing that powers your car. You will see several gears that mesh with each other with different numbers of teeth on them.
But doesn't a transmission require that to like change between ratios?
No, it just requires the power to be transmitted through a series of gears with different numbers of teeth on them, unless it's just one-to-one gear ratio.
Okay, so then a watch is a transmission then? because there's gears.
Well, it's not a car, so. Lots of things have gears that aren't cars. This is like robot or not.
Like,
now.
Is my hand mixer, is my electric hand mixer upstairs? That
exactly. Like, what about my KitchenAid? Does that have a transmission? Well, kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. What have we done? I have regrets. All right, let's bring us back around and let's do some follow-up. Jonas writes, I was a bit worried about the Time Machine iCloud backup, iCloud photo library thing, but it seems that it's included in Time Machine backups. And so I guess Jonas or maybe John found a knowledge base or whatever article about this. So tell me about this.
Yep, at apple.com. So we can be pretty sure they know what they're talking about. It says, Apple says, even if you use iCloud Photos, it's important you always back up your library locally using one of the followed methods. And the two methods they list are use Time Machine, and it claims that will back everything up, or manually copy your library to your external storage device. I think what I was misremembering last episode was, and I don't know if this is true, because all we have is this vague advice from Apple that says, hey, back it up, use Time Machine. So thumbs up on that. Maybe I was misremembering a thing where when you use Time Machine, it will not back up the SQLite metadata databases, but will only back up the photo files and the rest of the structure if you use iCloud Photo Library, because it assumes it can always regenerate the SQLite databases from the iCloud photo stuff. That's the thing now. I don't know if it's true, but apparently you're safe using Time Machine if you just want to back up the actual photos. And it will back up the whole thing, the whole photo library. There was just some big blow up a couple of years ago of people being mad that a Time Machine wouldn't back up some what they considered to be an important part of the photo library. And the reason they don't back it up is because if you use iCloud Photos, that source of truth is in the cloud anyway. So your local backup of it is just going to get overridden with what's in the cloud. And that's why I think they didn't back it up. So maybe more follow up on this in the future. But for the main question of will it back up my photos, the answer is yes.
Well, all right. There are some new monitors that we need to talk about. We talked about the Samsung 5K last week, and actually we have some updates on that. And then there's a Dell we need to talk about. But tell me, we have a little more information about the Samsung, I guess?
Yeah, we talked about the camera last time. We're like, oh, it's a 4K camera. It's a good camera, not like that crappy one on the Apple Studio display. Well, 4K camera is about 8.3 megapixel, and the Studio display has a 12 megapixel camera. I still think the one on the Samsung is probably better because we don't know what the crop factor is on that 4K camera, right? Apple's super ultra wide camera that it uses on the Studio display tracks you through a wide range of, you know, you can move all over the place, right? I would imagine Samsung is going to take a less extreme approach with its 4K camera. And when it says that it tracks you, I bet it crops out a portion of the 4K frame, but not as tiny a portion as the Studio display does. We'll see when the thing ships, but that's a software question more than a hardware one, but just wanted to clarify, 4K is about 8 megapixels and the Studio display is a 12 megapixel camera.
All right. And then Dell has a new 6K monitor that makes your XDR look like a pile of garbage.
It does not, but it exists as a 6K monitor. So here's what's important about it. It is a 32-inch 6K monitor, which is the same as the XDR. It has more pixels than the XDR. The XDR is also 32 inches, but the Dell 6K monitor is 6144 by 3456, and the XDR is 6016 by 3384. Sorry for reading those numbers that way, but that's the way my brain works sometimes. So the Dell monitor has 875,520 more pixels than the XDR. The PPI is very similar. On the Dell, it's 223, and on the XDR, it's 215. So this is a Mac-appropriate monitor with more pixels than the XDR. So this is looking pretty good here. Same size, more pixels.
It looks pretty good until you see it.
Well, yeah, we'll get there. It is not a fancy display like the XDR, though. It is an LG IPS monitor. It covers P3, but that's about it. It does 600 nits max, which is not anything close to the XDR's 1600 nits max. It has the good old familiar from last episode, Display HDR 600 certification. But according to Ars Technica, it does have local dimming. It has 12 zones. That's not good. All right. So the peak brightness
just turn it off at that point, right?
Yeah. The peak brightness is less than half of the XDR. And the XDR has 576 dimming zones. And even that is paltry compared to modern mini LED monitors that have way more dimming zones. 12 dimming zones is not good. But it does claim that it has a good IPS display or whatever. Anyway, height adjustable stand included, of course, with rotation. Because why wouldn't you have that on such an expensive monitor? That would be crazy.
Wait, it's not $1,000?
No, yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, this is CES. This is coming from CES, so we don't know the pricing of this. So we can't make fun of how badly priced Apple things are because we don't technically know about the price. But I'm going to say it's going to undercut Apple. It has a 4K dual gain HDR webcam that uses quote unquote AI to keep you in the frame. You know, sounds familiar, huh? This is apparently a dual gain HDR CMOS sensor with multi-element lens. The webcam has independent hardware tilt. So even though the camera is built into the monitor, you can apparently tilt it with your hand. It uses Dell Express sign-in technology to detect your presence when you're nearby and logs you in automatically, locking your PC when you walk away. You know, I want Face ID on the Mac, and I would love it if it locked the screen when I walked away because it knew I did that because of the camera. But I'm sure this is all like a Windows feature and not a, you know, monitor thing. It has mute and camera disabled.
If it works as well as the Windows face recognition thing to log in, you're not missing much.
Yeah, I mean, that's better than nothing, I feel like. But
it's not.
No.
It's worse than nothing.
If it worked as well as Face ID on my iPad and my iPhone, I would be happy. So, and I feel like Apple could make that happen someday, maybe. It has a mute and camera disabled touch sensors accessible on the front of the monitor because it's nice to be able to do those things quickly. 14-watt stereo speakers, auto KVM built in, lets you control two PC sources with a single mouse and keyboard, viewing content from two computers with picture-in-picture and picture-by-picture modes. I think you can put the two monitors like side-by-side, like two images on the screen. Connectivity. Of course, it has tons of ports. Why wouldn't it? Such an expensive large monitor, right? HDMI, DisplayPort 2.1, Thunderbolt 4, RS calls this Thunderbolt 4 downstream. I'm assuming that means that's how you connect your computer to it. I'm not sure. USB-C upstream, four USB-A ports, 2.5 gigabit Ethernet port, and a front panel with two USB-C ports at 10 gigabits with 15-watt power delivery and one USB-A port with 10 gigabits and BC 1.2 power charging, which is apparently an abbreviation for USB battery charging revision 1.2, up to 140 watts of power delivery. So it's not the same specs as the XDR. It's kind of an XDR for people who don't need 1600 nits, great color fidelity, so on and so forth, but just want a big single monitor with tons of ports and lots of features and all that good stuff. Unfortunately, as Marco alluded to before, it's ugly as sin.
It's so ugly.
Let me paint you a word picture. So imagine like a standard computer monitor with a ugly plastic base, you know, or stand on it. But as you look up, you notice that there's a forehead that must be a couple of inches tall. And that is way out of line with the bezel on the rest of the sides of the display.
And as big as the forehead is it so big because it contains the camera?
No, it does not, John. I'm glad you asked. Only half of the circular camera is within the forehead.
Half of the huge camera, like huge. It's like the size of a golf ball.
Right. And then the other half of this golf ball sized camera is above the top bezel. It's the top of the monitor. Mm-hmm. It looks preposterous.
It looks like an enemy from Half-Life.
Yeah, it's like so ungainly looking. Like anything where the bezel is bigger on the top than the bottom always kind of looks like the monitor is upside down and then it's got the big thing. You know, but if you look at the videos of this thing, the stand is you know, tilt adjustable, height adjustable, rotates, so many ports on this thing, so many features. It's got all the stuff that you can want. And I bet the price is going to be pretty good. And I don't think there's really any other game in town for, hey, I want an XDR, but I don't need, you know, 1600 nits. Now, as I said, when we talked about this and kind of the, you know, few months after I got it or whatever, I didn't think I would care about the HDR, but I really do appreciate it because my family's phones take HDR video and photos. And when I view them on the big screen where I do my photo editing, they look HDR. Like I actually use those 1600 nits and so do Apple's Pro laptops now. So I'm kind of at the point where if you had asked me before about the XDR, I'd be like, oh, I would just love something like the XDR that just doesn't have that HDR stuff that I don't care about. But now I'm kind of over the line where I think I don't ever want to buy a monitor that doesn't do HDR for my quote unquote good monitor. So in that respect, this one is not to my liking. But I think having a 6K monitor for people who don't care about HDR that has all the features and connects to all the things and has a good camera built in and everything, like if this thing is priced reasonably, I'm just super glad this exists because now we have an alternative to the, another alternative to the Apple 5K. And now finally we have something I never thought we'd have, an alternative to the XDR that, again, assuming it's not more expensive, is great to just have in the market for people who want a big monitor but don't want to pay $6,000 once you add the stand.
Yeah, and I'm guessing this is probably, I mean, not knowing anything about what these components cost these days, I'm, you know, Apple's at $6,000 from a monitor that's now a few years old that has higher specs in certain areas and, of course, higher design and everything else. I'm going to say this is probably going to be under $4,000 for the Dell one, and if I'm right about that, you know, even if it's $4,000, it's probably even going to be less than that. That's going to be a great deal. Like, for what you're getting compared to what else is in the market, I think this is going to be well under the XDR's price. Maybe
it has to
half,
be way less.
You know, it could be $3,000. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's probably going to be a really compelling price. And the money you're saving, you can buy anything that will make you not see how this looks. Maybe, you know, maybe like one of those, like, if you look through like one of those like cartoon ninja masks, like you're looking through a slit, if you can just cut off the top and bottom and not see anything beyond that. I don't know.
You know what I do think is kind of cool? It's really ugly, but I like the principle of it. So they have some, I guess, capacitive buttons on the bottom left-hand side of the screen. Not in love with that, but at least they have a button. Imagine how cool it would be if your studio display had a power button. That would be amazing. But anyway.
No, you know what? I love hearing about everyone's studio display bugs, because you know how many times I've had to unplug my XDR?
I'm gonna guess none.
Yep, correct. None. Oh
but,
wait.
Although, but once both of these monitors should have power buttons. Like even the XDR, which I've also had no problems with, it should still have a power button too.
No, it's an Apple device. It's not gonna have a power button. Their headphones don't even have a power button. Not a chance the monitor will.
But they should. That's we got them to add back the good keyboards, SD card slot, HDMI to the laptops. I think we can convince them that power buttons are a thing that electronic devices should have.
I know. I'll tell you, I actually for interesting reasons, I used someone else's 12-inch MacBook today, and it's the first time I've seen one of those in a long time, and of course the space bar is broken, but it did feel really small. It's like, damn, I wish this size still existed, but wow. Yep. I'm glad this keyboard doesn't still exist.
Yep. Anyway, next to these capacitive buttons, there's a little like original MacBook Air style door that drops, or not door, but like I don't know, like column that drops down that has
a USB-C hub is what it is, basically.
Yeah, so it has two USB-C ports on it and a USB-A port on it. And then you can, you know, shimmy it back up within the contents of the inside of the monitor and confines of the monitor. That's what I was looking for. You can, you know, slide it back up inside the monitor and it disappears. And I think I'm supposed to hate this, but I think I kind of like it.
No, front-facing ports, useful thing to have. So you don't have to constantly reach around behind the monitor. Like, this is exactly what PC makers will do. It's like, oh, let's just add all the features that we think will be useful. Sometimes inelegantly, and sometimes they go overboard, but it's such a nice... That's why Apple needs competition, and you need contrast. The Apple overly simplified thing is contrasted with this thing that has every feature anyone could ever think of. Somewhere in the middle is probably where we want to be, but it's good to have the two things balancing each other. So if you don't like what Apple has done, you have an alternative.
Yep.
Do you think as you type on your desk that this stand will wiggle the whole monitor? Or do you
think
it'll be
Dell usually has pretty good stands, and this one looks pretty sturdy. It's LG that can't make a stand.
I know. Yep. Well, but I used to love Dell monitors. Like back in the pre-Retina days, I had two Dell 24 inches and they were fantastic. And I mean, you know, at the time when those came out in, you know, 2006 or whatever, those were really great, very competitively priced, very well-performing monitors, and they were great. But that was a long time ago, and I wouldn't make any assumptions unless I've heard otherwise that they would still be even, you know, the same company, let alone making the same quality stuff.
Yeah. All right, John, do you need Marco and me for the next, like, 20, 30 minutes, or can we just take a little
You'll have to be my camera crew as I report from the CES show floor. It's my annual trip to CES that I don't actually take. This is it. So CES is going on. I've never actually been to CES, but I will be virtually reporting from there on the tiny amount of things that I actually care about at CES, and those are having to do with televisions. What's going on in the world TV is just a quick overview here. So
well,
first thing is...
Hold on. I'm curious before we begin. I know from being on the, you know, more computer side of things that CES does not have a strong correlation to what actually comes out of the market. Is that better for TVs? Like, do TVs have a better track record of what's shown at CES actually then gets delivered to the market?
Yeah. So for televisions, it has simply become the thing where, like, everybody, there's like an annual crop of televisions, and everybody just shows, with an asterisk that I'll get to in a second, shows their TVs at CES. They also show stuff that isn't a TV. Here's something we're thinking of. Here's something stupid, like the concept car equivalent. That crap is, you know, whatever, right? But the TVs they show, they ship them later that year. Unless something catastrophic happens, they ship them pretty reliably. So it's annoying that CES comes and you don't get prices and availability, but you basically know, look, this happens every single year. They show them in January. They're not yet ready to ship. Sometime during the year, probably around the middle, they're going to ship them. We're going to find out the pricing and availability, and then we do it all over the next year. So that is very reliable. So it's not like, you know, they give you the names, the model numbers and everything, right? So these are real products, not... You know, ignore the concept car stuff. Although I'll talk a little bit about the concept car stuff here too. So this year, the starting news is you can finally get Quantum Dot QD OLED screens in larger than 65-inch sizes. All the fancy TV people who have bigger houses than me wanted to buy my recommended TV last year, the Sony A95K, but like, oh, it only goes in 65-inch. That's the biggest size you can get, which is fine for me. My last TV was 55 inches, and I upgraded to 65, and that's about as big as I can fit. But there was nothing bigger. So this year, finally, you can get a 77-inch size. Samsung Display makes QD OLED screens. They are the only manufacturer that does. Every television that has a QD OLED screen comes from Samsung. Samsung announced a 77-inch television. Their naming scheme is not as good as LG's. Last year was the S95B that came in 55 and 65. Now you can get the S95C. I get it. You're incrementing the number. What is the S? What is the 95? I don't get it. Now there's also the S90C series, which is sort of their lower end model. So they've bifurcated their entire line. The S95C comes with what Samsung calls a One Connect box that they've had in their TVs for many years. Do you have that in your frame as well, Marco?
Is that where? So the frame has you run one like skinny cable to the TV, and it goes down into this giant box that has all the other ports on it that you hide in your entertainment center. And
that is the One Connect box, and that is exactly the idea to just sort of, it makes it easier to mount the TV, or you don't have to, like, it's I think it's actually a fiber optic on the modern ones. One little skinny cable goes to the TV, and there's a breakout box with everything else in it, the power plug, the HDMI ports, all. It's a good idea, but Samsung puts it on their fancy TV. So the S95C has the One Connect box.
Mine's buggy as hell. We have two frame TVs. They're both buggy as hell. I would never in a million years buy another one. Like they're so, and I don't know if it's because of the electronics being separated. Probably not. It's probably just because Samsung sucks. But man, is it buggy as hell. I would never do this again.
Yeah, I can't speak to the reliability of the One Connect box because obviously that's some proprietary thing that they're doing with the fiber optic cable, right? But in theory, the electronics that are in that box is the same as they would stick on the back of the TV. So if they suck, they probably would also suck on the back of the TV. But anyway, their fancy line S95C has the One Connect box. And it also has bigger and better speakers in the TV because now there's room for them. They basically have speakers taking up the whole back of the TV with, like, you know, openings on the back and everything for better bass. You know, so that's the S95C. And the S90C doesn't have the One Connect box, and it's more of the lower end model. So they've split up their QD OLED line into the good ones that have features you might not want, like the One Connect. Not so good one. All right. Speaking of One Connect box, LG has a product they call the Signature Series OLED TVs. It's just a WRGB OLED, not a QD OLED. And theirs are wireless. There's a power plug that goes to the back of the television, and then there's a breakout box, but the breakout box communicates wirelessly. They call theirs a Zero Connect box. Isn't that clever?
But it still has power. I mean, so what's the point?
Well, the point is, it's a lot easier to sort of mount the TV. Like, if you have to, like, be like Casey and mount it way too high over your fireplace or whatever, you just have to have power. You don't have to fish HDMI cables through, or like, lots of televisions have lots of ports in the back of them.
No, but I'm saying, like, when you have the one cable that goes to the breakout box, the way my stupid buggy Samsung ones do, what's the difference if you have to run a power cable to the TV or this cable to the TV?
Right, well, lots of people have a power plug near their television or behind where they're going to wall mount it, but not a lot of people have the special One Connect fiber optic cable fished through their wall to the box that they're going to buy with the TV. Not a lot of people have HDMI, or if they do have HDMI, it's not the right standard for HDMI 2.1 and whatever. This is a silly rich person TV, right? It's not a serious TV, but it is a real product. It's 97 inches. It's probably horrendously expensive. I just think it's interesting because they're sending real, full-fledged, not compressed, like full fidelity 4K 120 hertz video signal to the television wirelessly up to 30 feet away. I don't recommend this television. I just think it's interesting that we've gotten to the point where they can do that on a silly rich person TV. For people who, you know, if you look at the pictures, see how it's like the television itself is on one of those awkward stands that no normal person would have in their house, right? It's just kind of like freestanding and alone. Mm-hmm. I always make fun of the fact that they never show any power cables or anything else. Well, you can see the cable in this picture. It's just the power cable. It goes down one of the legs, and that's the only cable you need attached. So finally, it's a realistic picture, and you just got to find some place to hide this box. So there's that. I just thought it was silly. It's like the TVs that they have, like a TV that rolls up, and all the silly rich people TVs are just fun to look at. But they are real products. They do sell to real silly rich people. More seriously, from LG, their competition for QD OLED, because they kind of got trounced last year by having they didn't have a QD OLED TV. They still don't have a QD OLED TV. But what they have now is the micro lens array. They took their WRGB OLEDs, which are OLED TVs that have a red, a green, and a blue subpixel, and then also a big hunk and a white subpixel next to it. They took that TV, and on top of each pixel, they put tiny little microscopic lenses. So on a 77-inch TV, every pixel has 5,117 lenses on top of it.
Every single pixel?
Every single pixel. There's a lot of pixels on a 4K TV. Yep. They're micro lenses. It's a junior mint. It's refreshing. Bananas. All right. You can look at some of the pictures. So what's the point of these little lenses? The point of the lenses is to take light that would otherwise be lost to internal reflection as light passes through the various glass layers. Because when you send light through, anything there, you lose some of it due to internal reflections of light that doesn't make it out to people's eyeballs. The micro lens array makes more of the light make it through without losing less of it to internal reflection. So you don't need to run your backlight, You don't need to run your pixels brighter. You just get more of the light that you're producing out to people's eyeballs. And that is their competition for QD OLED. You also get better viewing angles because, again, more light is leaving the display going to eyeballs and less of it is getting stuck inside the display. Less off-axis, color tinting, all of the things that were problems with WRGB OLEDs that weren't problems with QD OLEDs, they're combating that with the micro lens array. So it is brighter. The estimates are it'll be about 1,500 calibrated nits on a 10% window. When we say that, we mean make a 16x9 box that is 10% the size of the TV. That can be probably around 1,500 nits. Full screen, 200 nits. This is what TVs have been like for years, by the way, if you don't know. Like, if you make the entire screen white, you get 200 nits, right? If you make a 10% window white, 1,500 nits. This is relying on the fact that most real television content is not like 100% white, but that scene in The Matrix is pretty close. So just keep that in mind. This is an increase from last year's model. Last year's best LG model was 933 nits on a 10% window and 172 full field. So this is a big jump in brightness thanks to all those little tiny lenses. Obviously, you'll have to wait for reviewers to get these TVs to compare them. Samsung's QD OLEDs are also brighter this year. So it'll be quite a competition. Obviously, the things QD OLEDs still have going for them is they don't need a bunch of little micro lenses because they're just naturally better at putting out light because they have fewer layers to go through. And the part that produces the light is closer to literally physically closer to the surface. They have naturally good viewing angles and their brightness doesn't rely on the white subpixel. So while you can get a 10% window at 1500 nits that's pure white, you cannot get a 10% window at 1500 nits that's pure red, because that white subpixel is doing a huge amount of the work. If you add up the brightness of the R, G, and B subpixels in a QD OLED, you get the white, the full brightness. If you add up the R, the G, and the B subpixels on a WRGB OLED, you get like 10% of the brightness. Most of it is that white subpixel, which tends to wash out colors. So I still feel like QD OLED is the future and is the better technology, but kudos to LG for finding a way to get way more brightness out of their TVs and come up with a technology that should make, I feel like, their top-end TVs competitive with QD OLEDs this year. We'll see. Second to last, Samsung's, I'm not going to say like silly concept car thing because these are real products, but they're real products for fabulously rich people. Micro LED. Every year you see micro LED at CES because it is the best technology. This is non-organic LEDs where every single pixel has a little red LED, a little white LED, and a little green, not red, red, green, and blue, right? RGB, which is unlike the current ones, which just use a single LED that they pass through either color filters or quantum dots or whatever. No burn-in problems, instant response, no white subpixel, amazing viewing angles. This is the promised land of television technology. It also costs like $30,000, right? And the big problem with micro LED TVs has been, we can't make the little LEDs micro enough. So you see them in stadiums all the time, like those big screens at like a basketball game. those are not really particularly micro, but those are LED screens. They have red, green, and blue LEDs for each pixel. Making them small is really, really hard because we can't economically make a bunch of tiny little LEDs. So the way manufacturers have been making these for years and years is they make sort of like a subboard that, you know, is a micro LED thing with a certain number of pixels. And then they checkerboard those things together to make a complete TV, right? Because they can't make one board the size of a TV. They could just make a bunch of subboards and put them together so you can't see the seams, right? And the problem has been the smallest one you get is 300 inches. And then the next year, the smallest one you get was 200 inches. And the next year, the smallest one you get was 100 inches. And by the way, they always cost like 10 grand, 30 grand or whatever, right? But you just couldn't make them small enough. Well, this year, Samsung was showing micro LED TVs in sizes from 50 inches up to 140 inches. Those are real TV sizes. So from a tech perspective, we can now make micro LED TVs in the sizes humans can fit in their homes, just not at the prices humans can afford to buy them. I don't even think there are prices attached to these. You know, it's one of those kind of, if you have to ask, you can't afford it. But anyway, the sizes that come in are weird. It's 50, 63, 76, 89, 101, 114, and 140 inches. And those sizes are a result of basically the size of the little unit, you know, the little the checkerboard thing. When you stick a bunch of those together to make a 16 by 9 display, these are the inch sizes you end up with. But they're 240 hertz, they're low power, they have amazing color, phenomenal brightness, no image retention ever. I can't wait for this technology to arrive. Hopefully we will have affordable micro LED TVs before my eyes get so bad that I can't appreciate them.
Hey, wasn't there a rumor just a few days ago that an upcoming Apple Watch will probably use micro LED?
Yeah, there's been micro LED Apple Watch rumors for 5 years. Micro LED, I mean, it's not like all the technology is never going to come, because every year at CES, the micro LED TVs get better and better. But yeah, the rumor that Apple's going to use them in some device someday, they will eventually, but they don't even have OLEDs on their laptops yet. So let's, you know.
Wait, wasn't the factory that they did they bought a factory in Arizona, mm-hmm. And then the whole deal fell apart and stuff. Wasn't that for micro LED?
I think there was one of those was for quartz for something, like the display quartz, yeah, or whatever. But they did make a big investment in micro. Everyone's investing in micro LED. Everyone knows this is the next step. And like all the different things that I talk about of these TVs doing stuff so they don't suck as much. QD OLED was the most recent big step. Look at all the crap we don't have to do. No white subpixel. We don't lose light by cutting through color filters. Amazing viewing angle. Low power. Thin. But you still have image retention and you can't get as bright as an LED backlight, right? So there's always caveats. Micro LED, the only caveats were we have to make a bunch of small ones and stick them together so you might see the seams, and we can't make them that small. And they're working on those. So the size, we've got it. 50-inch micro LED 4K televisions at 240 hertz. It's gonna happen. Maybe in the next 5 years. Stay tuned. And the final item that I thought was interesting, second to last, actually. Roku is making TVs. Roku makes those little set-top boxes. And if you have a TCL TV, it probably has Roku built in. You got a little Roku remote. Roku is making TVs, but the TVs will be manufactured by TCL. But currently, a lot of the TVs that TCL makes that have Roku built into them are designed by Roku. And Roku just basically hands TCL a design for a TV, and then TCL makes it. So now Roku is making its own TVs, which have Roku built in, but they're being manufactured by TCL. It's confusing, but you know, it's kind of like if Netflix started making TVs. Well, maybe not Netflix, is their streaming service, but Roku is one of the few sort of competitors remaining standing in the, you know, software that runs your TV. You've got WebOS, Google TV, Apple TV, Roku. What am I missing?
Amazon.
Fire TV. Yeah, but Amazon is kind of losing steam in that thing. Didn't Amazon also make a TV, like an Alexa TV type thing?
I believe that's right. I recently bought a new tailgate TV. So this is a TV that basically has to be not impressive. It just needs to be relatively light and cheap. And
by the way, the most Southern thing you've ever said. I just bought a tailgate TV.
He's talking about it on the show before, yeah.
I'm flummoxed because I don't have a good retort for this, mm-hmm, as you're probably right. Anyway, the one we bought, I think it was like $110. It's like a 32-inch. I don't remember if it's 720 or 1080, because, again, it doesn't matter. We're going to be looking at it outdoors. But anyways, it's a Amazon Fire TV. It's whatever the Insignia, maybe, which is, I think, the Best Buy store brand. And the only reason I went to Best Buy was because it was dirt cheap. But yeah, so that one is an Amazon Fire TV, and it is not great.
Yeah, I feel like Amazon is kind of losing the interest in that market, and Amazon's kind of consolidating a lot of stuff. So I'm not sure how long they're going to be there, but they do have a TVOS. And the final thing is Sony. Sony is at CES, but they're mostly showing like PlayStation stuff and their stupid car that we'll talk about someday on the show because it's been in the show notes forever. They weren't showing TVs. I will put a link in the show notes to a YouTube video from someone who tries to explain why this is. They have new TVs that are coming. The theory of this person is, and probably an informed theory, is they just didn't feel like talking about them at CES because they fancy themselves being in the Apple position. Apple famously does not go to CES, hasn't for decades at this point, because Apple doesn't have to. Apple doesn't need to be at a place where media attention is focused. They just make their own events and tell people to show up, and that's all. Sony apparently doesn't feel like they have to show their televisions here, because they'll just show them in a couple weeks. And then when that happens, they'll be the only story. Instead of just being slotted in with 50 other stories about what's going on at CES, it'll be, the new Sony TVs are out now. I think this is the first year Sony has tried that move, so we'll see how it works out. The bad news is that I don't get to know what new TVs Sony has, but the good news is that they don't make their own panels. They sell QD OLED TVs. They're going to have one of the new QD OLED panels. Panasonic already has TVs announced with the new QD OLED panels, and people are testing those. And Sony's going to get the same exact panels. It's such a shame that Panasonic doesn't sell TVs in the US anymore, because they make such good TVs. I might have bought a Panasonic if they still sold here, because their tastes tend to align with mine. But yeah, Sony is just trying to be its own its own story at some point in a few weeks, rather than announcing at the show, which is kind of weird. And it's also weird that they showed a car, but again, we'll talk about that in a future program.
So does this make you regret your semi-recent TV purchase? Is there something that you see here that you think you could feasibly purchase if it was available today?
No, it actually makes me glad, because in particular, Samsung splitting its line into like the best stuff is only on the thing with the One Connect box, but the weird, I don't like that they split the line like that, because last year the TVs, the best TVs were just like normal person TVs. No weird breakout box, no weird super thin design, not the one that sold without a stand, right? They were just regular TVs with regular TV features. And this year, Samsung splitting the line would make it hard for me to choose among them. And maybe Sony will do the same thing. Whereas last year, it was easy. Sony A95K, if you have my set of values of what you want out of TV, that was the one to get. I'm sure when Sony comes out with new TVs, they'll have one that is better than my TV, but not enough for me to want to upgrade. Like, considering how long I kept my plasma, I'm going to be riding this A95K probably until something goes terribly wrong with it. And then maybe I'll replace it with a micro LED. But no, I'm interested in the market because display technology is super important and it will affect all of our devices eventually. I just feel like Apple is, not that they're lagging behind, because the displays on the laptops in particular are phenomenal. Like, those mini LED screens have amazing specs and look great. And I think are the right choice, especially for a computer screen, where I just think OLED, OLED is not great because you got image retention. And in particular, QD OLED with its, the subpixels are arranged in a triangle. It screws with like text display. Even if you don't do subpixel anti-aliasing, which Apple doesn't, it just doesn't quite look right on a computer display. It looks a little bit weird. So I don't know what the answer is, but all of this television technology will eventually affect all of our devices. Already, we've got OLED screens on our phones, and that's been pretty great, I think. I want an OLED screen on my iPad. Someday, we'll have micro LED screens on all our Apple devices. The TV world is kind of a preview of that in terms of manufacturability, pricing, and what they can do. So even though I'm not in the market for a TV, and none of these TVs particularly tempt me, I do like keeping up on it.
That's fair. That makes sense. All right, there's been some new news over the last few days that apparently Qi 2 is being worked on, and I guess it's just MagSafe? Like, that's what everyone seems to be saying from an article from The Verge. With the blessing of competitors, Apple is about to change the Qi wireless standard itself. It's contributing a new version of Qi that works much like MagSafe, magnets, authentication, and all. It's called Qi 2, and yes, it effectively means that MagSafe is coming to Android, for better or for worse. Samsung and Apple are both expected to put Qi 2 certified products on the market. Wireless Power Consortium spokesperson Paul Golden tells The Verge, and he says there's no reason to think future Qi 2 certified chargers wouldn't work with both. There's also no reason to think a future Qi2 charger wouldn't work seamlessly and identically with both Android and iPhones, he says, when I ask. That's because Apple, a WPC, quote, steering member, quote, and a chair of the board of directors, is contributing essentially the same magnetic power profile as MagSafe to the new Qi2 standard. I also read somewhere in here, though, that the magnets, apparently the arrangement is ever so slightly different. I don't have a pull quote for you right off the top of my head, but I guess the magnet array arrangement is slightly different on Qi2, which makes me and The Verge wonder, does that mean it won't be compatible with the iPhone that we have today? Like, how is that going to work? Nobody knows. But
I think it just might be an improvement, like a 2.0. Like, if you look at one of the points that's made in this article is that kind of unlike, well, maybe it's not unlike, you know, the made for iPhone thing where you'd have like lightning connectors and stuff where you had to like do it the right way. You had to sort of get the lightning connectors through Apple or certified by Apple or whatever. But you could also say, we don't care about that. We can figure it out. Let's just make something that works in the Lightning port, right? Here we're making a charger. We don't want to pay whatever Apple is charging to use the official Lightning thing. With MagSafe, that has happened even more. It's a ring of magnets. Cheap case manufacturer, like, look, I don't, whatever you have to do to like certify that you're MagSafe compatible and use the, like, let's not do any of that. Let's just put a ring of magnets. And it, you can find it. Does it work? It more or less works. Like the car mount that I have, I don't think that's MagSafe certified. It was like a $20 car mount. It's a circle with magnets in it that's roughly the size that it has to be. Like, I think if they make changes to the magnet arrangement, it's going to be like that, where, yeah, it is different, but it's close enough. And it'll work, and your thing will stick to it, right? And we know from like the battery packs and stuff that you buy for phones, some of them attach more strongly than others because they use maybe bigger magnets, thicker magnets, stronger magnets, right? Additional magnets, layers of magnets. It's not the type of thing where, you know, like a wire protocol where you either it works or it doesn't. You just kind of have to have the magnets in the neighborhood. So I think whatever Qi2 ends up being, I would expect it to work well enough with all of our existing MagSafe stuff.
I mean, it can't be that much worse than Qi1, right? I mean, you know, I think the... this is good news in the sense that MagSafe really was and is an improvement over Qi. You know, Qi charging has a lot of upsides, but it has a couple of really big annoyances. You know, number one is that it's super slow, and I guess number 1B that it's also super inefficient, which maybe should be a number 2. This is why we've run a show called Top 4 that never has 4 entries. so anyway, yeah, so it's super slow, it's super inefficient, and we've all had that experience of having like a Qi charging mat next to our bed or something and thinking our phone is charging on it overnight, and you wake up and you realize, oh, it wasn't quite aligned right and my phone didn't charge overnight. Yep. And MagSafe improves that. It improves it by a decent amount. All of those problems are still there, though. It is still slow. MagSafe just makes it less slow. Part of the reason it makes it less slow is that the magnets align it correctly much more of the time, and it has that kind of communication mechanism where it can verify. Like I know, you know, we've also maybe had, I don't know if you ever had the experience of placing a metal object on a Qi mat accidentally, coming back a little while later, and it's maybe a little warmer than you would like for comfort. I have, so that's not fun. And MagSafe, you know, I think part of the reason why it doesn't deliver its 15 watts of max power to everything is that there is some kind of like authentication mechanism where it communicates and makes sure that what's on the other end of that thing is a device and not like a Yeti cup. So I speak from experience.
Qi chargers are not coasters.
No, although they are cup warmers if your cup is a Yeti cup. Not recommended.
Don't put your Yeti cup on your induction stove either. This is all the same thing.
Yes.
Like electricity and magnetism.
Right. Yeah, anyway. So, you know, having MagSafe be incorporated into the Qi standard, you know, we already know what this does. The automatic alignment of the magnets does enable more efficient charging, because you don't have to worry, like, well, we can still send power to this even though it's only, you know, 70% in the target zone. We'll just kind of fudge it with induction and we'll lose more to heat and it'll charge more slowly, but oh well. MagSafe takes care of that to a degree. It also, by having the alignment, reduces the error rate of, I think my phone charged overnight, and then it actually didn't. Now, it doesn't actually eliminate that error rate. I know this from using a MagSafe glued to my end table, or, you know, double-sided taped to my end table, every night for the last, like, 3 years. I know that I still occasionally have times where I think I feel it clip on, but then I wake up the next morning and, oh, it was actually not all the way on and it didn't charge. But it happens way less often with MagSafe than it did with the like flat Qi thing I had before. So MagSafe is better than Qi. And so it does make sense to modify Qi to incorporate magnets in basically the same way. And this is not the only time this has ever happened. USB-C itself was heavily contributed to by Apple, because the PC world, we see what they do when they make a port without Apple's input. That's how you get the USB 3 micro B plug.
Or USB-A, the connector everyone loves to hate. Externally symmetrical, internally asymmetrical. It's like a cruel joke.
Right. So anyway, so this is a good thing. And you're right that it does effectively kind of formalize what the industry was already unofficially doing. There's so many third-party things that are like, it's magnetic charging. And, you know, they don't say MagSafe. It's magnetic charging compatible with your iPhone, but it'll only be 7.5 watts or whatever. You know, those are all just, you know, imitation MagSafe things. So it makes sense to have this be part of the ecosystem. The only thing that I would pour a little bit of water on is this is still not going to be better than wired charging in certain ways. You know, we know, first of all, wired charging can still be higher power. It's still more efficient. And it's still, you know, in some ways safer. It still allows data transfer, which this doesn't really. So, you know, wired charging is still going to exist and still be popular. It's also cheaper. So, you know, it's still going to exist for a while. But this is a good thing to formalize and unify what is a fairly obvious improvement to the Qi standard. And hopefully unify iOS and Android devices into using the same thing and all the benefits that brings. But
look, it happened without government intervention. And I say that both to blame the government and to blame Apple. Because see, Apple, if you just get off your butt and do what's good for the industry, you avoid government regulation, I would say. And see, government, eventually, even pig-headed companies like Apple will see the light and unify on a standard. And on the USB-C front, like as you said, this doesn't, you know, is this how Apple's going to comply with the USB-C? They're just going to do MagSafe ever? They could, but they would have to add substantial data transfer to MagSafe probably, or have some other way to do data transfer wirelessly. It would be a big complication if they went totally portless. I mean, there's been rumors of that for ages. I don't think Qichu factors into it any more so than just to say that Apple is clearly very dedicated to the MagSafe connector and it will continue to exist on phones and maybe even other devices in the future because it's not going anywhere. But yeah, standardizing on it for everybody, you know, it already was standardized. Like USB-C was everywhere except Apple. It's kind of like electric car connectors. It's standardized everywhere except Tesla and kind of Nissan still. But you know, like, so we're so close. Like, and so that's why all these laws are essentially Apple laws. Or if there's ever a law about it for chargers in the US, it'll be the Tesla law, right? Because we don't need any law to force standardization. It happened on its own, except for one pretty darn important player, whether that be Apple or Tesla. So at least on the wireless charging front, we didn't have to wait for that. Apparently everyone got their acts together. And it's kind of a shame. Like I said, like Apple was heavily involved in USB-C. It's just they did Lightning first. And yeah. I think they should have done Lightning first. We enjoyed the benefits of Lightning for years before the rest of the industry went USB-C. But now it's time.
The other thing about Qi 2 also is that it presents the possibility, although they're vague on the details, and of course Apple's not saying anything, that maybe in the future the Apple Watch and other, you know, smartwatches that have non-flat or smaller contact areas than what we currently use for Qi could possibly be charged by some kind of part of the Qi 2 standard. I really hope that plays out. Because right now, like, you know, the ideal case would be if you're traveling or something, you could have basically one type of charger with you. Again, you see the USB-C versus Lightning debate for years, right? Ideally, you have one type of charger and you can use as many devices with it as possible. Smartwatches throw a whole wrench in that because they don't have any ports, and you know, and so you have and they're so small. You know, whether it's an Apple Watch or the other ones, they all have these. You know, usually they have custom induction-based charger techniques or something, or maybe little pins on the side that you have like little flat custom plug that, you know, MagSafe's onto them or whatever. So there's all these different charging techniques for these super small devices that are too small to have, you know, Qi or even oftentimes USB. And so if Qi 2 has good provisions in it to allow smaller devices to maybe unify in something, whether it's, you know, an Apple Watch or a Fitbit or Garmin things or whatever else, that would be fantastic. I really, really hope that's part of it, and I really hope Apple's on board with that and moves in that direction. But I know better than to get my hopes up too far on that.
All right, Future Marco, hello again. How are we feeling? Do we want to do the Rewind AI thing? Do we want to skip to Ask ATP? I'm leaning toward Ask ATP, but what do you guys think?
I like doing the, let's see, we've been live for an hour. With that,
yeah, but you're going to end up cutting. But you're going to end up cutting a bunch of that car bullshit that I took us all on.
Yeah, probably. I'm probably going to lose 5 minutes of that. So, let's say, let's see, how long is the rewind thing?
It's probably, I was going to say, it probably won't take that long, will it?
Yeah, it's mostly just to talk about a link to this guy's blog and to hit the highlights.
Yeah, let's do rewind, and then we'll do the big Ask ATP question, and we'll see where we are from there.
Cool. All right, go team. Bye, Future Marco. All right, we got an email a few days back, maybe a week or two back. I forget exactly when this was, from Kevin Chen, who has spent some time looking at how Rewind.ai works. To remind you, Rewind AI is John's favorite thing, Livestream! And it's the thing that will record everything that happens on your Mac, and it will let you search for it and so on and so forth. So Kevin spent some time going through and figuring out how it works. Now, I can't confirm or deny anything that Kevin said, but it rings true to me based on what I know about these sorts of things. It sounds like this is accurate. So we're not going to read Kevin's post. It is worth reading for the record, but I'm just going to kind of quickly hit the highlights. What ends up happening is Rewind uses accessibility APIs to identify the frontmost window, and it stores the timestamps of, I guess, when the window changes in a SQLite database in the user's library folder. I wonder if they're using Blackbird. You never know. It takes a screenshot. It takes a screenshot of the screen that contains the frontmost window. And if there are multiple screens, only the currently focused screen will be captured. A new screenshot is created every 2 seconds. And then it uses Screen Capture Kit, which we'll put a link in the show notes, to hide disallowed windows, including private browser windows and a user-defined exclusion list. Then it will OCR the screenshot on device using Apple's Vision Framework, the same pipeline that powers live text and Masquerade as well. And then it'll store the inference results to a SQLite database. It then periodically compresses the screenshot sequence into an H.264 video with what, gentlemen?
I'm gonna say incredibly inefficient. Yeah, FFmpeg, and I was surprised to see that because Apple has tons of libraries to compress video. Maybe they don't have ones that take images as input. But there was a question, I think, in the blog post from some people: does FFmpeg use the H.264 hardware in all of Apple's computers?
I thought it did. I'm not certain.
I think it probably does too, or at the very least it has an option that you don't remember.
Yeah, there are various like modules and options. I mean, because FFmpeg is not just one set of things. It's like there's a whole bunch of different mm-hmm. optional things that could be bundled into it or whatever else. And some of those things do use the hardware acceleration.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, it's not an MVP, but this is the first version of a product. And using, I mean, I don't know how else you'd do it. It just seems like they're using Screen Capture Kit and Apple's Vision Framework. I would have expected to see them using whatever the appropriate, was it AV Foundation, whatever the appropriate Apple library is to do this work rather than FFmpeg. But either way, it's probably pretty efficient.
Yep. And then additionally, if the user joins a Zoom call and enables transcription through Rewind, it will transcribe the audio on device using the OpenAI Whisper model. Then it stores the transcripts and speaker information into a SQLite database. And so then Kevin did some benchmarks and whatnot. So CPU usage when recording on his 14-inch MacBook Pro with an M1 Pro processor, Rewind uses about 20% of the CPU continuously.
Then
Rewind Helper, which is, I think, the thing that does the transcoding or manages the transcoding and whatnot, spikes over 200% CPU every time the temporary PNG images are compressed into an H.264 video.
Now,
that's
we know whether that's efficiency cores or the high power cores?
Oh, that's an interesting question, and I don't think we know.
I mean, that's the problem with CPU percentages, because remember, 100% CPU is not all of your CPU. It's all of one core, according to the way that Apple's activity monitor does stuff. So 20% sounds like a lot, but on a laptop, like you want it when it's idle, you want it to be idle. And if it's using 20% of even just one core continuously, that's not great for battery life. But again, you know, what are you getting for it? You're getting live streams, right? So I think it is being as efficient as it can be. Modulo a few things, like later in the article, Kevin goes into some suggestions for how this could be improved, like not writing out pings, but instead of going straight to the H.264, or I would say, like, if they're shelling out the FFmpeg versus statically linking with the library, that would be something to look into. But again, it's version one.
I would say too, though, I mean, just for, you know, CPU load wise, like when you're running an M1 or M2 based Mac, if you run something like iStat menus, like Casey and I, and definitely not John, do, you will see like your efficiency cores are running at what on Intel machines would be a kind of an alarmingly high percentage. Like, you know, mine right now, the efficiency cores are hovering around, looks like about 75% use, and that's kind of constant. And one of those things is Zoom, but oh well. The other thing is just Windows Server, though, which again, Zoom. But like, it's fairly common for me in fairly idle use to look up at my menu and see my two efficiency cores being used very heavily by kind of just regular system activity or background things like photo indexing and everything. And from what I understand, and I think this matches my anecdotal experience so far, from what I understand, the kind of real noticeable battery life cost to one of the efficiency cores being maxed out is basically nothing. You know, it's very different from, you know, from the high power cores. If you're maxing out your high power cores, that's a different scenario. But the efficiency cores, with a battery the size of a modern laptop battery, I get the impression that you're basically using those for free.
Interesting. Continuing on with the Rewind stuff from Kevin Chen, the storage usage. So the screen recordings are chunks of about 180 megs an hour. The metadata OCR results and call transcripts, which are, again, the SQLite database, are about 26 megs an hour. Console logs, about 4 megs an hour. With regard to security, Rewind currently doesn't encrypt data at rest. Any app with full disk access and any attacker who encounters an unlocked computer has the ability to read recordings from all time, including soft deleted clips. That's also not stupendous. And then other notable things, resources/favicons. There's a directory of 912 favicons, I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that, for popular websites stored as PNG images. Examples include Amazon, Dropbox, YouTube, etc. These are used in the timeline view when the frontmost app is a web browser instead of showing the browser's app icon, which is kind of cool.
Such a 1.0 thing. It's like, we just need to ship this. Don't worry about it. What do we do about the icons for the things? We'll just ship 1,000 of them. Like, I mean, obviously, you would think, why don't you just go to the web and get them? Oh, then you got to make a network request, and it's all complicated. And I love that they just ship them all. Like, just our app bundle will be bigger. Marco would never do this. No. We're just going to ship 912 of what we think are the most popular websites PNG images of all of their, I would say, fave icons. I thought that was funny. So it's implemented in a pretty straightforward way, in an explicable way. With a lot of 1.0 stuff, the data not being encrypted at rest is not great, because, you know, it's bad enough when someone gets access to your computer, but that is a treasure trove. Like, it's already OCR'd text, and you've got all the screen images, and just like, this is the problem of like, well, if it never leaves my device and it's not using cloud transcription and so on and so forth, everything's done locally, it's nice and secure. It's like, yeah, but now you've just made, I don't know, like the equivalent of like collecting evidence against yourself and putting it in a little box and wrapping it up with a bow. Not that you're doing any bad things, but in terms of privacy, you probably don't want anyone getting at that, because they could just sort of go through that and see what you've done for the past day, 2 days, week, month, year. It's up to you to kind of be studious about like, well, I want to exclude, you know, private windows. Don't show it when I go to my bank website, like whatever you want to do. But, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. But anyway, it's implemented in what I think is a fairly straightforward way. And I thought this was a really interesting examination of how it works and what it takes. And your point, Marco, about the efficiency cores is important, because that's kind of what they're there for. It's not like when you write a program, you can specifically target things. But there's scheduling on macOS is really weird. But there are APIs when you run code in a Mac application that you can tell the OS and the threading job service that you're using through whatever API you're using, what priority you want. And if you say something like low background, like all have different words for the priorities, you'll end up running on the efficiency cores pretty much exclusively. There's also some other details about core affinity of whether your job stays in the same core, bounces around, and how that affects cache or whatever. But I think everything this is doing is sort of below the level of notice of a modern M class processor, because it's not, you know, the stuff that it's doing that's complicated, like the text kit thing, the vision framework of parsing text, that's got to be optimized to hell and back. Like, the Apple did that work for you already. That's already efficient. It's already going to be fast. You don't need the results in real time, right? So it can be, it's asynchronous in the background and you're not in a big hurry. So I bet that it does pretty well. Screen capture kit, again, Apple optimized that to be able to capture your screen without destroying your Mac and making it slow and unresponsive. So that's great. FFmpeg, I feel like, is a weak point here, because as optimized as it may be, I have to think that any Apple framework would be even more optimized. Even if the FFmpeg thing is just calling into the Apple framework, I believe
that is exactly what it's doing. If you configure it properly, like Marco was saying, and it's Video Toolbox is the, I don't know why it's called Video Toolbox. Maybe that's an Apple thing. Maybe it's an FFmpeg thing. But that's what FFmpeg calls the like front end to Apple APIs. And I actually did, just for grins and giggles, look through the Video Toolbox code like a year or two back. And it looks like, if memory serves, and again, this is a year or two ago, I'm pretty sure it's just calling into AV Foundation. Like, I don't think it's doing anything.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, the sort of, you know, the marshalling of the jobs, however it's dealing with threading or background tasks or whatever, in an Apple framework, you could give it a batch of work and let it do that in a way that is most efficient on your M whatever processor, whereas at FFmpeg, you're kind of doing that manually, deciding, you know, how many jobs you want to run, how many cores you want them to use, even if each individual one is just using AV Foundation behind the scenes. Same thing with, like, for the OpenAI thing. I don't know if Apple has a solution to that, of the transcribing speech into text. I think there's an Apple solution, but OpenAI is a popular open source one. I think when someone was digging into this, they found the OpenAI, maybe it was Kevin, found the OpenAI model file in the executable one, like the speech model file there. I'm not sure if they're using the OpenAI like library, which I think is written in C++, to do it. But, you know, as the advertising material said, this is actually a good demonstration of leveraging Apple's platform APIs to build an application that you otherwise would not be able to build without Apple's help, or other, you know, these libraries they're using make the application, right? If you had to write all these libraries yourself from scratch, it would take you many more years and many more millions of dollars. But because Apple offers these frameworks, a company can make this product in way less time with far fewer people. And I think that's pretty cool.
Video Toolbox is apparently an Apple thing, real-time follow-up. And we'll put a link to it.
People will be familiar with it because you see it in the menu in Handbrake and you know it as the thing that makes my encode go faster.
Gosh, I haven't used Handbrake in forever, but you are not wrong. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. We got a really fascinating one from Stefan Jacobs about a month ago, I'd say. It's been a while. But we were trying to find some room to fit it in because this might be the only Ask ATP we do for the day. So Stefan writes, during the recent discussion about Twitter, you briefly discussed the analogy of leaving Apple platforms if someone at Apple made decisions of a similar nature to those being made at Twitter. The options are obviously not great. Neither Windows nor any of the various Linux distros offer anywhere near the attention to detail and polish that Apple has put into its platforms over the years. So here's my question. If someone were to build a third alternative mainstream OS that could host a hypothetical wave of Apple refugees, what are the key things they would need to get right? P.S. Optional clarifying parameters if needed. And since I'm talking to John Syracuse, I'm sure they are. Let's assume that Apple has a less stark advantage in processor hardware by the time this happens. And to begin with, the OS would probably need to be able to run on third-party hardware, although tight integration a la System 76 would presumably be possible over time. John, tell me about System 76. What's the context here?
I don't even know what that is. I just to click on the link.
Oh, all right,
seen
good.
It before. Let's see.
Oh, it's a Linux laptop vendor. I see. Okay. So it's Linux laptops that are supposed to be like MacBooks. Got it. All right. So anyway.
Just like every other laptop.
Right. Yeah, fair. All right. So here's my question. I'm repeating. Stefan writes, so here's my question. If someone were to build a third alternative mainstream OS that could host a hypothetical wave of Apple refugees, what are the key things they would need to get right? Would anyone like to start?
I mean, one thing I want to say right off the bat about this is, because Twitter is the context of the thing, a key factor in this hypothetical is that if Apple ever went the way of Twitter, and there are many things preventing that, not the least of which is that it is not a private company owned and controlled by a single person. If Apple did go in that direction, the self-destruction, the implosion of Apple makes it possible for there to be an alternative. Like, I think Mastodon, for example, getting so much more activity and becoming more popular happens because Twitter is self-destructing, right? And so if you look at this question, every time we talk about it, it's like, yeah, but like, it's basically impossible to make a competing phone platform, desktop operating system, what, you know, tablet, whatever you want to say, it's basically impossible, right? But if Apple self-destructed, that's a power vacuum. Something would fill that vacuum. So I don't think it's entirely ridiculous to think if Apple did implode and just sort of, you know, if Apple pulled Twitter, let's say, it would make an opportunity for someone to fill that void. And I think that someone, if someone did succeed to fill that void, they would probably be vaguely Apple-ish, kind of like Mastodon is vaguely Twitter-ish, but also learning from the mistakes of Twitter. But, you know, kind of trying to appeal in the same way to sort of a small group of early adopters like Mastodon did or like Apple did, right? So, you know, I complain that people's hypotheticals are not realistic. I have to say that the implosion of Apple itself makes this somewhat more realistic.
All right, so what's important?
I mean, I think number one would be, we know, you know, there are some similar challenges as with social networks of, you know, chicken and egg problems or getting network effects going. And, you know, in an operating system, one of the biggest challenges is software compatibility. Like, what's going to run on this? And so I think the best way to bootstrap this would either be to base a new operating system on Linux or on Android. And I don't love either of those options for lots of reasons. But, you know, what we see with the Mastodon explosion, you know, as John was saying, just in the wake of the Twitter implosion, part of the reason why Mastodon is so much more appealing to many of us nerds who care about these kind of distinctions compared to something like Hive or Post or whatever is, as I was saying a few episodes ago, like now that we've been burned by the big closed ecosystem of Twitter, the idea of something being open and protocol based and not being in the hands of just one big company, it's like, okay, well, now we learn that lesson that one centralized big company is bad. So we're going to now apply that lesson and not let that same mistake happen again. Well, we have that same problem with Apple. They've just been a good enough steward most of the time that we haven't jumped ship. But if Apple did go bad and cause us all to jump ship in some way, I would want to then make sure that same mistake of that big centralization couldn't happen again. And I'd rather set up shop on Linux than on Windows. Also, I mean, it helps also, like, I might have said Windows a couple of years ago, but in that intervening time, I've had more experience with Windows.
You've used Windows.
Yes. Yeah, like,
what you should have had is more experience with Linux, and that might change your mind.
Fair enough. But, like, it's almost, you know, Linux is, as I said many years ago, it's almost like going to live in the woods. But, like, I think I'd rather go start my own civilization in the woods based on the foundation of Linux than to live in the hellhole that is Windows any more than I have to. And I over the years, whenever we'd insult Windows on the show, we'd hear from people who are like, you know, it's better now. You should try it. They've really made it a lot better now. And, you know, I was starting to believe these people. But now I've actually used it firsthand, modern versions on modern hardware, and I can say without a doubt, it's not that much better. It is a little bit better. It's not that much better. And it is not something I want to use still. So whatever the new OS would be that I would want to invest my time and resources in would hopefully be a Linux-based thing. Android would be a little bit better in the sense that Android would provide that app compatibility, but it's not – like Android would provide crappy app compatibility. And not to say that Android apps are crappy. They are, but for this point, I'm, you know, it's more about – it's like the cross-platform nature of Android apps of like running on like a general PC operating system. It makes it a pretty crappy experience. Like if anyone's ever used – there are already ways to run Android apps on PC operating systems, and they're terrible. Like they're very clunky. Heck, look at Catalyst on macOS. It isn't that much better. You know, it's not a great experience. So Linux, I think, would be the best long-term place to invest. And so I think what a third-party alternative OS would have to be, I think, would just be a really good Linux distribution that invests heavily in the like desktop and laptop user experience, which we've seen smaller efforts of this over time with Linux. None of them have ever really gone anywhere, but I think that's what it would have to be. And if there really was a big Apple implosion and there were all these talented, opinionated people who wanted somewhere to go, that I think would be way more likely to succeed than either Windows being, you know, becoming appealing to this crowd, which it never will because, I mean, God, just try it, trust me. So either that's not going to happen, or a whole new OS starting from scratch that wouldn't be able to run any of the software from any of the other OSs we have now, I think that's a no-go because software compatibility is just too important. And the fact is, Linux actually has pretty decent software compatibility with a lot of stuff that a lot of people want to use these days. It's not amazing. It's not as much as Windows or Mac or Android, but it's not as bad as you would think if you haven't tried it recently. So that's where I would go with it, is like, start with Linux and just make a really good distribution that has a really significantly improved experience around key areas for desktop and laptop use.
See, but I think you're majoring on the implementation details, and I don't think that's the spirit of what Stefan was asking. I think what Stefan was asking is, what would you look for in an operating system that would make it feel like home or like somewhere you could, you know, pitch your tent, so to speak? And so when I read this question, what I was thinking of is like, what would appeal to me? What are some of the core things about macOS that I wouldn't want to give up? So some of that is, you know, kind of hand wavy things like, well, attention to detail, which it's hard to get specific about that unless you're talking about like something, you know, at a micro level, but in general, like a good attention to detail, a good visual design. But then I started thinking, okay, well, what are the things that I love about macOS that I never really experienced on Windows? And maybe that's because I never took the time to learn, but macOS has incredibly robust, like, keyboard shortcuts and keyboard support throughout the entire operating system and every app within it. And you can do so much with the keyboard, particularly when you're using the keyboard in combination with a mouse. And so I think like robust keyboard shortcuts and keyboard support is also important to me. I wonder if now I'm starting to get into the implementation details, kind of like you were, Marco, but I think a good developer story is powerful. I would argue that part of the reason that Macs got so darn popular in the early to mid aughts was because the developer story was so good. It was a Linux computer, not too dissimilar than a lot of the web servers that, you know, that we were all writing code for, but it was a Linux computer right there on your desk and you didn't have to do a VM or anything. It was right there.
What are you talking about as a Linux computer?
Well, okay, Unix. Sorry. Excuse me.
I saved you a lot of feedback.
Yes, you did
save
me.
And it wasn't just a speaker.
No, you're right.
Not a Linux computer.
You're right. I'm already getting blown up in the chat room too. Anyways, so you know, you're right. It was a Unix computer. It's a Unix system. I know this. It's a Unix computer right
Wait,
there.
Wait, is BSD like? There's going to be somebody who writes in and is like, actually, it's
no,
not quite 100% Unix compatible.
This was before your time. Apple got.
Official
all caps Unix certification for macOS 10.
Oh, really? That wasn't just for
there's a great story on the internet about the person who led that effort. I'll see if I can find it for now.
I remember that. A good story. I don't know if I'll be able to find it, but that was a very good story. But anyway, but to finish kind of the thoughts I had, you know, having a good developer story, I think, is important, although maybe I'm too much indexing on what's important to me and not what's generically important. But speaking of generically important, I think what's pretty great about macOS in a way that, say, Swift wants to be but kind of isn't, is that macOS does do a pretty good job with progressive disclosure. So to do basic stuff is fairly straightforward. To do intermediate level stuff is kind of hard, but not terribly hard. And to do hard stuff is hard, but it's possible. And that's, I think, a really important thing that I would want to see in whatever this new operating system I would potentially be using. So I don't know if you guys have anything along those lines or if you'd rather go back into the nerdy stuff. That's fine, too. But that was the sort of thing that I was thinking about that when I was reading Stefan's question.
I think they're kind of connected. When Margaret was talking about bootstrapping and how like you've got like the problem of like, well, you know, for a platform, you need people to make app store and everything. I thought where you were going, and Casey, you kind of glanced off this as well, is the developer story, not in terms of what does the platform offer for developers, but in terms of what developers are drawn to this platform. Like the only reason the Mac even still exists is because Apple bought Next. And part of that was the developers who had been developing for Next, an obscure platform that nobody cared about that sold computers to colleges, right, for $10,000 each, was because those developers, they came with the platform because, like, where the hell else are they going to go? You're going to write Objective-C's for somebody else, right? They came with the platform, and those are the ones that made the great Mac apps that defined the Mac for the new generation. There was also the classic Mac OS apps that were great. I mean, some of them are still around, and then we bring, like, Microsoft Office and Photoshop for sure. But sort of the renaissance of the Mac in the early days of Mac OS X was because Apple had essentially purchased a developer community filled with really good, interesting developers that share values that we have. So for a platform that's going to appeal to us, I think it would have to come with or be attractive to the kinds of developers who make the apps that appeal to us. So we got the Next and the AppKit Objective-C developers before. You know, if it was some other platform, we'd have to be like, well, what is the platform that those type of developers, either literally those people, because some of those people have been moved from platform to platform again because they're not writing Next apps anymore, right? Or people like that, whatever the current equivalent of that is. If they're attracted to the platform and they want to make apps for it, we would be attracted there as users and, you know, in some respects as developers, because those are the type of people. Apps don't come from nowhere. It's not like, oh, you just have, you know, a platform and it should have good apps. Where do they come from? People make them. The kind of people who made classic Mac apps when no one had heard of the Mac and they were really expensive. The kind of people who are making Next apps when nobody heard about Next. Like, the things that appealed about Next and the Mac, and it's not just that Steve Jobs, you know, involved making both of them. Those qualities, even though they were so very different. Next, BSD, Unix-based system for schools, you know, no color, grayscale screens initially, right? Objective-C, weird programming language, you know, just the user interface didn't really look anything like the Mac. But the things that appealed to AppKit developers are the same type of things that appealed to Mac developers. And it was kind of a natural marriage of those things for the current Mac platform. So I think any platform that I would go to after the Mac, I would basically be following that muse. Where are those people going? Where are people like that? Where do they want to be developing stuff? Because that's where I'm going to live, because they're going to make that a nice place for me to live. In terms of the Twitter Mastodon, like, don't go a place owned and controlled by one company, blah, blah, blah. Don't think we have a viable model for that for computing platforms that involve hardware. Obviously, there's the web, the platform no one owns. And I think the web is awesome. I spent my entire career programming for the web. I think it's great. But the web relies on the existence of devices that you use to view the web, whether that's your phone, your laptop, whatever, your television. Those hardware devices are made by companies that probably also have some kind of platform thing going on there. The web does not provide a solution to that. And talking about the qualities of the platform I would like, one of the things that always attracted me to Apple is the marriage of hardware and software. The same company controls both of those things enough to make them marry together to make a single device that is pleasing. So even if we're just talking about let's just say it's the web, the platform no one owns. You're just going to have a Chromebook equivalent type of thing. All it does is browse the web. That solves the platform problem. You don't need to have an API. It's all web apps, whatever. Someone still needs to make that hardware. Someone still needs to deal with power management and the neural engine and live text on the web. Like, everything that Apple does now, you need some company to do that. And that company is going to be one single private company. I don't think there is a model for, you know, a federation of small, equally competitive companies working on an open platform. Someone's got to own and control it enough to be able to make hardware that appeals to me. So it would have to be a single company, right? And like, built on an open source, you know, Mac OS X is built on BSD, you know, which, and Darwin open source, like this open source stuff underneath all this, right? We're all standing on the shoulders of all the giants that came before. But in the end, the Mac operating system, iOS, iPad OS, those are proprietary operating systems made and controlled by a single company that marries them directly to hardware that it also controls and with chips that it designs and, you know, all the way up the stack. So that is a quality of the thing that I would go to that I think it has to exist. Microsoft is out, not because I dislike Microsoft or think everything is bad, but they just have so much legacy burden. They will never get out from under that unless they literally burn to the ground, right? So they are held back by their legacy, yeah, which is also the thing that makes them billions of dollars, right? And in some respects, that's true of Apple as well, right?
I don't think Microsoft would ever make something great. They don't have it in them. They don't have the right priorities.
Xbox is close.
No, I mean operating system wise.
Yeah, well, Xbox has an operating system. It does, but it's debatable, right? There's been some great things that, but everything in Microsoft is held back. The strategy tax at Microsoft is off the charts, even under new leadership. And you know, nowadays, Microsoft is like, oh, it's just the best place to run Linux because you know the Windows operating system has a Linux subsystem, and like, I don't count Microsoft out, and they're doing much better. But the legacy, like the thing that makes them money, the thing that runs that company, will always necessarily make that operating system not appeal to me, because they can't just say, we don't care about our existing customers. New thing. Even Apple couldn't do that. Even Apple had to do Carbon. It's just that Apple was starting from a place I like better. So that's why I'm counting on Microsoft. Google's good at the web. Google's not particularly great. I mean, they make good phones, like the Pixel phones do a pretty good job there. Chromebooks is not a great laptop as far as I'm concerned. I like the idea. The implementation is not great. So I don't think this is an existing company. I think it would have to be a new company filling that power vacuum, attracting whatever the modern equivalent of the Mac or Next developer community, or maybe like the BOS development community is kind of similar, although in hindsight, the Next developer community had more forward-thinking technical ideas, right? You know, doing everything in C++ was cool and fast in the 90s, whatever the hell B was. But boy, am I glad that we're not all living on a platform that was built on a foundation of C++ at this point. Objective-C was, in hindsight, a way better choice. And then Swift, hopefully, even better going forward, right? So I think the pieces are there for someone to pick up those pieces and build an operating system that I would like. And I think that's how it would have to be. It would have to be marriage of hardware and software, the kinds of developers that made the Mac what it is, and all the errors of the Mac being attracted to that platform, owned and controlled by a single company with leadership that has taste. That's the final thing I would throw in there. Like, and when we say has taste, we mean has the same taste as us. That's why we like Apple things. That's why we like all the things we like. There is a particular, that's why the developers are drawn to there. Like, why were developers interested in writing Mac software? A lot of them wanted to write it because the screen looked really nice and you had proportional fonts and a bitmap display with tiny little pixels. Who cares how big the pixels are? I cared how big the pixels were. I didn't even know how to program. But even other Apple platforms, like, look, the Apple 2GS has a mouse. I'm like, the pixels are the size of boulders. Oh, but it's got color. Have you seen the size of the pixels? I cared so much about that, and I couldn't understand why everybody else would look at like a CGA screen and they'd be so excited because theirs had color and mine didn't. I'm like, I'll look at Dark Castle all day long before I look at your CGI game, even though your game is quote unquote in color. Are you kidding? That's the type of values and quote unquote taste that I'm bringing with me, and I'm going to go where those developers with that same taste go.
It's a pretty good answer. Marco, yeah. Any final thoughts?
No, he's frustratingly correct as usual.
Oh, a story of the last 10 years, am I right? All right, let's see how many more we can squeeze in real quick. Andy Clark writes, there seems to have been a lot more talk about RSS recently, probably given Twitter's troubles. Do you use RSS, and which reader apps do you use for iOS and or Mac OS, excuse me. For me, I stopped using RSS a few years ago. It just kind of faded out of my life. And I was using Twitter both in terms of what are people talking about and a list I specifically had for news. And I was using Twitter for that. Now I am feeling a little bit of a void in that department. So on my to-do list of something I want to explore is, you know, rebuilding an RSS list and start using RSS apps, reader apps again. I really enjoyed the app Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R, last I was an RSS person, which was, again, a long time ago. But I think I would probably start with NetNewsWire, to be honest with you, which is written by a few friends of ours. And I haven't used it in years and years and years and years, but I see some chatter about what they're working on in a Slack that the three of us are in. And it sounds like it's pretty slick these days. So I'd probably take a look at either of those. Marco, are you using RSS?
I never stopped using RSS.
Fair enough.
And I'm not, you know, not just in the technical sense of like, well, you know, podcasts are based on RSS. It's like, no, that's not, I mean, you're right. That's correct. But that's not what anybody means when they say this. But yeah, no, I've never stopped using an RSS reader. For the sync backend, I like using, what's the hamburger one? Is it Feedbin? Yeah, hamburger icon. Yeah. So Feedbin is my sync backend, and you can use any of a whole huge list of clients with some of these sync backends. And on the iPhone, I use an app called Unread, which
used that years ago too.
It's kind of like if you ever use like the Clear app for your to-dos or shopping lists, where it's like very opinionated, very limited, and very gesture-based. It's kind of like that for RSS readers, and I like that a lot on the phone. You know, I have a lot of muscle memory there, and I enjoy the design of it quite a bit. On the Mac side of things, I've bounced around a lot. NetNewsWire is what I should be using. I'm currently still... So for a while before NetNewsWire was back, I used an app called ReadKit, and which is very much in the spirit of old NetNewsWire. And ReadKit, they had a new version come out that I think is now based on Catalyst or something, and it doesn't fit me as well. Like, the new version doesn't. So I'm still on the old version on my Macs for now. And then at some point, I have a to-do list item to move to NetNewsWire. Because NetNewsWire is the one that is, I think, by far under the most active development on the Mac. They also, I'm pretty sure they have also an iOS version now. I haven't looked at it yet because I'm so happy on iOS with Unread. But certainly I would if, you know, if you're starting fresh, I would start on NetNewsWire and you know, only branch out if you really have to from there, because that's the one getting the most active development. As for RSS content itself, I continue to give the same advice I've given for, 15 years, whatever long it's been that I've been using, longer than that, that I've been using RSS readers. Don't just go and subscribe to, like, the giant high-volume feeds from whatever the big blogs are that I used to say, like, Engadget and stuff, but that's most of those don't even exist anymore. But, you know, don't go add just, like, you know, the New York Times front page, the Verge front, like, don't just add a whole bunch of high-volume stuff. RSS is ideal in the standard RSS reader paradigm, and there are lots of ways to consume it. You don't have to do it this way. But the way most of them work as kind of, like, this big kind of inbox-style thing, it is ideal for subscribing to any number you want of infrequently updated things, like John's blog or my blog or Casey's blog. You know, all of us, I mean, Casey updates more than John and I combined by a good margin, but it's really good at that, because, like, there's no cost to following an infrequently followed or an infrequently posted blog. So all the blogs people have that have been kind of mostly abandoned or become low volume in the last decade, go subscribe to all of those from anybody that you know. And then when it comes to the high volume stuff, subscribe to a very small number of those, because what you don't want to happen is the RSS reader to all of a sudden be this thing where there's thousands of items piling up unread and you're just not seeing them. I mean, and you could, if you wanted to, you could switch to, like, the river approach, where you don't even try to, like, quote, keep up. And you just dip in whenever you want and just browse what's on top, and then, you know, come back later to see more. That method doesn't really work for me. For me, I do like the inbox / keeping up model, but I shrink everything down. So, for instance, I don't subscribe in my RSS reader to 9to5Mac and you know, Bloomberg and all this stuff. Instead, I subscribe to Mac Rumors. And Mac Rumors will link out to anything in that broader ecosystem that I really need to see. And then otherwise, it's smaller volume sites, like, of course, Daring Fireball, Michael Tsai's blog, which is awesome, Pixel Envy, Six Colors, 512 Pixels. Like, that's the stuff I read, like, in the Mac world on my RSS reader. And that's all fantastic stuff. And then a whole bunch of small blogs and stuff. But it's great for that. And if you need any help finding feeds, I know NetNewsWire actually comes with a, like, stock default set that you can adopt if you want to. So that's a good place to start.
John?
I'm not in the default set, though. A little sore about that. I need to leverage my personal connections to get that in there. So I'm a NetNewsWire user from way back. The first time I saw NetNewsWire, I took to it like a duck to water, because it used the same key bindings as TIN, T-I-N, which was my preferred Usenet reader when I was in college.
Wow.
And it looked kind of like TIN in terms of the arrangement, because TIN was a character-based application that you used in a terminal window. You used curses, right? So it wasn't a GUI app, right?
Oh, my God.
But it had the same type of thing where you'd go through the groups, and then you'd see the message list, and then you'd see a detail pane with the message you're looking at. and NetNewsWire use the same key bindings, and they're like VI key bindings where you just literally hit a key and T space bar, like, you know, no command strokes because it was like VI, right? So I was like, wow, here's this, you know, shiny Aqua macOS 10 application for reading RSS feeds, which are becoming really popular, and all the key bindings are like tin, and it's awesome. And I used that for so long until it kind of got bought out and found new ownership or whatever. And now this new thing is kind of like when Twitter for the Mac went away and then had a resurgence as the Phoenix Project. NetNewsWire, the original author of NetNewsWire, our friend Brett Simmons, eventually got back the rights to NetNewsWire and rewrote NetNewsWire. Like, it rose again from the ashes. Here is NetNewsWire written again in a modern language with modern APIs by the original author after many years in the wilderness. And it is a phenomenal newsreader for the Mac. It is a phenomenal Mac applications. If you use Mac applications if you use Mac applications, they feel sluggish. They don't feel sluggish because you don't know any better. Until you launch and use NetNewsWire and you realize, oh, so this is how fast a Mac application could be if it wasn't written using WebKit or whatever, you know, Electron. Everything is so fast and responsive. It is simple, straightforward. It is very understandable to me, at least, because I've been using NetNewsWire forever. It still kind of has tin key bindings, but they've changed the UI to be less tin-like or whatever. But anyway, I use that on the desktop. I used to use Feedbin for years and years when I was using various different readers and syncing services, so I'd be all in sync. But since NetNewsWire has iCloud support, I finally stopped paying for Feedbin. I think I still paid for this year. Maybe it actually just expired. I don't know. NetNewsWire will use your iCloud account, just CloudKit, I'm assuming. And I don't have iCloud Drive disabled, so it works for me. So I don't pay for Feedbin anymore. But back when I paid for Feedbin, I also use Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R, like you mentioned before, on the phone. But there's also NetNewsWire for the phone. And in general, on the phone, I don't use RSS. It's more of a desktop experience for me. I used to use Reader on my iPad a lot, but, you know, I don't know. I feel like Twitter has not replaced RSS for me. Twitter supplanted as the majority, stream that I use to consume stuff. And now I'm not all on Mastodon. I'm like half on Twitter. I'm both on Twitter and Mastodon. So the combination at this point of Twitter and Mastodon is still ahead of RSS in terms of prioritization of where I find things. But NetNewsWire is my preferred RSS reader on the Mac, and I'm kind of a completionist, but not really. Like, I subscribe, Marco wouldn't like it. I subscribe to tons of things that I know have too much volume. And sometimes I'm not a completionist. I just mark them all as read. I say, well, I'm too behind on that. I don't care. The way I would organize my feeds, and I have tons of feeds, I used to have folders for things. Like, I had a folder called infrequent, which was things like, this is a folder full of things that I do actually want to keep up with because it's blogs that post twice a year. Right. So I'm never going to just mark all them as read. Whereas these other sites that post 50 things a day, just mark them all as read. And they're in subfolders, and you can mark an entire folder as read with a single keystroke, and it happens instantly. So I use RSS like that, where I don't go through the river of stuff. I just look at things that might be interesting. And then there are certain feeds that I read literally every single thing that comes out of them because they're so infrequent or because I care about them so much.
All right. I think we're good.
All right. End it there?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Memberful, Collide, and Sanity. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join at atp.fm/join. And we will talk to you next week.
Forgot to mention the NetNewsWire is open source.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So if you want to learn how to write a good modern Mac application, like, how is NetNewsWire so fast? You got the source code. Take a look.
John, you have been wanting for a couple of weeks to talk about the Mercedes EQS brake pedal. And let me start by making clear the Mercedes EQS is their electric sedan. And it is
not
a good looking.
Not a sedan.
Oh, I'm sorry, not the sedan. What's the sedan? You're right. What's the sedan's model?
I think they're all called the EQ. I gotta find the thing.
I hate Mercedes model names. Yeah,
EQS? It's like EQS SUV. Let me see.
Oh, all right. Should we just restart that? We can just try this all over again.
No, I actually have to look up the answer to that before we do that.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So I'll reboot the whole damn thing in a second, but let's figure out the answer to this. Oh my God. Cookie words everywhere.
Shop online. Shop online.
What is it? MBUSA.com. Oh, God. See, bootleg people. This is
so there. Yes. Yeah.
Electric.
So there is an EQS. There's an EQE. What do they call the... It's called the EQS SUV.
I hate this so much.
These all things all look the same to me. Yeah, I think they just call it the EQS SUV.
Hold on. Vehicles, I must have a definitive answer. EQE, EQS, EQ.
So that's the E-Class and the S-Class sedan thing. So those actually are sedans.
Okay. So there is an EQS sedan.
Yeah. Okay. That's like the S-Class. Just like it's EQ and then S. EQ and then E. But I'm saying, like, what the hell is the SUV called? I think it's called the EQS SUV, which is confusing.
I hate this. All right. Let me restart this whole thing. So, John, you've been wanting to talk about Mercedes brake pedals for a while, specifically the EQS, which apparently can be either the sedan or the SUV. But let me tell you, the Mercedes electric sedans, the EQE sedan, EQS sedan, not good looking cars.
Why are there few good looking electric cars? Like, this should be easier, shouldn't it?
Everybody wants to, look futuristic, and that leads them in interesting directions. And of course, the BMWs don't look weird. They look like normal BMWs, but the normal BMWs now look ugly. So, like,
yeah.
I was going to say, if you want an electric car that doesn't look odd, BMW just takes their regular cars and makes them electric because they built a platform that they can do that with, but they look like BMWs.
Oh, wait, timeout. Breaking news from all in the chat room. Model S/X steering wheel retrofit, $700, available March 2023. Travel in luxury, enjoy the warmth of a heated wheel and the touch of a premium vegan leather in a traditional form factor. No stalks or shifters.
Note,
this retrofit is only compatible with Model S and Model X vehicles configured with a yoke steering wheel. Purchase price includes installation through Tesla service.
Imagine if they just put those on the car when they sold them.
Imagine that. Wouldn't that be novel?
Flat bottom.
Oh, it is a very, very slightly flat bottom.
You cannot have a round steering wheel anymore, and I hate it so much.
Oh, quit your whining.
I mean, it's
flat bottom's not that big a deal.
That's huge. So you'll be able to order the full steering wheel again.
Well, it says March 2023, so probably in 2025 you'll be able to get it.
Never trust a date from Tesla.
that's incredible.
Give them your money now, probably, though.
No, I bet you can. Well, no, it says email me when the item's available to order. Wow, that's
what's comforting about this is that the fact that they have to offer this option shows that just no one liked it. Like, and like it, enough people didn't like it that they actually were forced to offer it.
Tesla's having demand problems, as they say. They're not selling as many cars as they wanted. And I'm sure in the discussion of how can we sell more cars, one of the items that had to come up is, I do hear a lot of people saying they don't like the yoke steering wheel.
Imagine that. Yeah.
And we already did design a steering wheel for this because I remember the pictures of it, you know, before the yoke came out. There were official images from Tesla that showed a round steering wheel. That's why everyone thought it would be an option. But then, you know, Elon decided, no, it's the yoke for everybody.
Well, I thought weren't there some regions where the yoke was totally illegal and so they had to sell it like this?
Maybe. I mean, just because it's illegal doesn't mean they're
I guess that's true, yeah.
What do laws matter?
No, right. Honestly, anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting. I'm actually not tempted at all by the new Teslas, in part because of, you know, Elon Musk being a jerk, but also in part because, like, now that I've had a car for the last few months that is designed to be used instead of a car that's designed to look good, I'm actually kind of spoiled by a lot of the utility of it.
I'm not sure that Teslas are designed. Well,
There's buttons, there's handles, there's compartments everywhere. The cup holders have little rubber inserts, so stuff doesn't slide around. Like, there's just, oh my god, it's just so designed to be used by humans. And I mean, of course, as an off-roader, you know, the Defender's also like very, very well designed for that. But just like, there's just stuff everywhere that helps me use it as a vehicle. And this is why, like, I'm actually not super tempted by the Rivians right now, because Rivians are also designed kind of with the Tesla mindset of, like, let's make the most minimal interior possible.
I don't think they're in the same mindset. They're more electronic than you might think, but I think they do have a different vibe than Tesla. You should go sit in one.
I think the overall features of the car do, but the actual, like, dashboard and controls are very, very Tesla-like.
No, they've got stalks and stuff.
Not
just try it out. I mean, go to the dealership and look at one and sit in, and you'll see it. It's not as far from a regular car.
There's a dealership in Richmond, for God's sakes. If Richmond has one, then almost every other city should. Anyway, all right, let's go back to this Mercedes stuff. Sorry for interrupting, but I think this is hilarious. Imagine people want an actual friggin' steering wheel, but no, Elon's a genius. Elon knows best. Anyway, Mercedes EQS SUV brake pedals. Tell me about this, John.
Yeah, so this is related to when we were talking about how any control that in a car or any other thing that is manipulated through a touchscreen or other electronic means, it's difficult to also have a physical control for it, because then the physical control can get out of sync with the electronic control, and you have to figure out how to deal with that. And we started talking about how, you know, like the faders on a audio board, sometimes the faders are hardware things that slide up and down, but they will move on their own. So if you change a level through a software interface to make sure that the hardware always matches the software, the hardware will literally move. And there was also some car that did that, where if you turn the volume up on the steering wheel control, the volume dial would turn or whatever. And we talked about dials that have lights around them, you know, dials just spin forever, but they also have lights around them to indicate the position and all sorts of this. You know, how do you have physical controls, but also software controls, or even just how do you have a control that you can control in more than one place with physical controls while trying to keep them in sync? How do you deal with that? Right. So Mercedes had an interesting solution here on their EQS SUV, where they've got, like many cars, they have a regenerative braking function, which basically means when to slow the car down, rather than squeezing discs inside the wheel wells to make, you know, heat and friction and slow the car down, instead they use electricity and magnetism to essentially charge the battery. You use the momentum of the car to charge the battery by regenerating energy. And as you charge the battery, that will slow the car down, because the energy to charge the battery has to come from somewhere. It's coming from your kinetic energy of the car moving, right? That's called regenerative braking. Cars have ways to adjust that. How much regenerative braking do you want? And you would think, well, we don't want all the regenerative braking. But what they mean is, how much regenerative braking do you want when you lift up on the gas pedal, right? So in a regular car, but in an internal combustion car, if you lift up on the gas pedal, the only thing slowing you down is wind resistance, rolling resistance, friction, right? The car doesn't start, it doesn't, you know, slow down due to the brakes, right? With regenerative braking on its maximum setting on Teslas and other cars, as you lift up on the brake pedal, it starts regenerative braking. So it doesn't just like give less power to the wheels. It actually starts robbing the kinetic energy of the car and using it to charge the battery. So your car slows down. I think maybe the thing people might be familiar with like this is maybe the golf carts work this way, I think. I don't golf, so I don't know. But I think like there are some other electric vehicles you might be familiar with, or maybe bumper cars, where they work the same way, that as you lift up on the go pedal, it becomes the slow pedal, right? Regenerative braking off means, oh, it works like an internal combustion car. You lifting up on the gas pedal does not slow the car in any way. The only thing slowing the car are friction and wind, right? And so if you're used to an internal combustion engine, you might want regenerative braking totally off. But if you're used to what they call one pedal driving, you can just drive mostly entirely with the gas pedal, because as you lift up on the gas pedal, it essentially applies the brakes, the regenerative brakes, in proportion to how much you're lifting up the gas pedal. Now, Mercedes has the same settings. Do you want super duper regenerative braking for one pedal driving, where you basically never need to touch the brake pedal unless you're doing emergency braking or something? Or do you want it to behave like internal combustion engine? But what Mercedes has decided to do is reflect the braking state in the brake pedal. So in normal regenerative braking, as you lift up on the gas pedal and it applies the regenerative brakes, the brake pedal doesn't do anything. Now your car is braking, but the brake pedal is in its fully up position. So Mercedes says, well, if we're applying the brakes at all, we should move the brake pedal down to reflect the amount of braking that we're applying, so that if you were to take your foot off of the gas pedal and put it onto the brake, it would reflect the fact that, hey, you know what? The brakes are actually applied like 50% already because of how you let up on the gas pedal. So the brake pedal will be 50% depressed when you put your foot over there. Now, I've never driven one of these cars, so I can't say, but this, you know, MKBHD did a review of it, and he found it extremely disconcerting to take his foot off of the gas, the accelerator, and reach for the brake pedal with that same foot and not quite know where that brake pedal might be. Because how low will it be? Like there's even like this intelligent braking thing where it will apply regenerative brakes based on like how far the car is in front of you or how fast you're going and what the conditions are, and in turn reflect that in the brake pedal, which may be in any position between completely up and maybe not completely down, but halfway down. And I think this attempt to make the physical control reflect what the car is doing, I understand the motivation, but I think breaking the muscle memory of always being able to find the brake pedal, especially in an emergency situation where you take your foot off the gas accelerator real quick and go for the brake pedal. I want that brake pedal to be in the same expected spot every single time. And I don't mind that the first 2 inches of travel doesn't do anything because that much braking was already being applied, because in that situation, you're probably slamming on the brakes anyway. So I think this is a pretty bad idea. I give them points for trying to do it, and it's relevant to our past discussion, but I think the muscle memory of being able to always find the brake pedal is so much more important than correctly reflecting what the car is doing.
Yeah, yeah. This is, before I address that, real-time follow-up, new model S's and X's give you the option to order the steering wheel or the yoke, no cost difference. So before everybody writes in. But yeah, I think, I don't know, do you ever have one of the old cars that had early versions of cruise control where it would do this with the gas pedal? Because I had that before.
Yeah.
I've driven a U-Haul moving van that did that. Yeah, so like, when you'd hit the governor, it had like a governor like 55 miles an hour. And when you hit 55, the gas pedal would push back on your foot. This is something that Marquez said on the video about this, too. The brake pedal will sometimes push back on you in this automated weird mode, too. Do not like.
Yeah, like it made a little bit of sense, or rather, it wasn't too disruptive on the gas pedal on those old cruise control vehicles, because that was kind of fixed in place. It wasn't a dynamically responding thing. And I feel like the gas pedal, it's okay to not quite be where you expect it to be, because, you know, you just lift your foot off or whatever. You know, it's less damaging. Whereas like the brake pedal, I feel like there should never be any like moment, even a split second of, oh my God, where's the pedal on the brake pedal? Like, it should always be where you expect it to be. It should always feel how you expect it to feel. There should never be any variation or any doubt in your mind that the brake pedal is where it's supposed to be and about to do what you need it to do. And so anything that kind of plays with it and makes it dynamic is just ultimately a bad idea.
This is one of those things that when I read about it or listen to someone talk about it, I think to myself, okay, that makes sense. I can get behind that. But I suspect that once I got behind the wheel and experienced it, that I would quickly sour on it and sour on it real, real hard. So I don't know. I'd be curious to try this for sure. Again, sitting here now, like, yeah, that makes sense. Why not reflect the state of the world? But golly, I have a feeling that not knowing exactly where the brake pedal is, which is the thing I need urgently, like you both were saying, that I need urgently, I need it immediately, and I cannot be surprised about where it is. I don't know if that's really going
to
work.
Yeah, and I think when you're going for the brake pedal, what you want is to get in contact with that control ASAP, because until your foot is touching it, you can't do anything braking-wise. Like, you have to get in contact with it. So that argues for both it always being in the same place and also for it being at the top of its travel before you activate it, because that's the closest to you, right? And you always just want to, you know, that sort of, oh, I'm going to go to the brakes. You want that. You want to get in that contact as fast as possible. If it is in some position other than all the way up, A, it's going to be farther away, and B, you've got to like start hunting for it. And depending on how you move your foot, you could miss it entirely. Like, if it was depressed three quarters of the way and your heel was like, you're the type of person who goes to the brake without like moving your heel that much because your car is set up that way, and you just press your foot down with your heel hinging in a certain spot and your toe goes all the way to the floor because you like missed it entirely, that's potentially not a great situation. Now, this discussion brought up, I think it was Quinn Nelson said somewhere, that he's like, I hate the people who buy electric cars and don't put regenerative braking on a max. Tesla's one pedal driving is the only way you should do it. You should always be one pedal driving. The old way is for internal combustion. The only reason we're used to it is because that's how cars used to work. Everyone should one pedal drive. Regen should be on max. And he said, also, you're just wasting energy if you don't do that, because if you're not one pedal driving, you're being less efficient. And I was going to reply to him, but I'm like, first I said, is there something I don't understand about, because it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm like, how would it be any less efficient? I mean, the way I thought it worked, and apparently I was wrong about this in Teslas anyway, is like, whether you are applying braking power by lifting up on the gas pedal or applying braking pedal by pressing on the gas, the brake thing, you're applying braking, right? Like, it shouldn't make a difference. It's not as if in a non-regen mode, applying the braking doesn't do regen. That would be ridiculous. So I was like, maybe he means that when people drive the old way, they're more likely to dip into the friction brakes. And what I mean by that is most electric cars, you know, when you press the brake pedal, it will do regen, but regen can't stop the car as quickly as friction brakes. When we say friction brakes, we mean the little things squeezing the discs or pressing against the drums in your wheel wells. So they have to blend regenerative braking with the actual old-fashioned hydraulic brake fluid-powered brakes, right? And I was thinking, maybe he means when people don't do one pedal driving, they tend to push the brake pedal and they get past the regen part where they push the brake pedal far enough where the car says, okay, I've given you all the regen you want and you still want more braking. Now I have to start pinching the friction brakes. And anytime you use the friction brakes, you are burning energy because that's just going off as heat. You're losing that. It's not going back into your battery at all, right? So maybe he was saying, like, you should use one pedal driving because with one pedal driving, you will never engage the friction brakes because that's a different pedal over there. And the people who don't do that dip into the friction brakes too much. But what it turns out that apparently he was talking about is that in Teslas, now you can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding from reading the thread. In Teslas, the brake pedals only do the friction brakes. That can't possibly be true, can it?
So I always got the impression driving it that when you push the brake pedal, you are controlling the friction brakes, period. And that the car would decide when to regen if you're decelerating, but you don't actually push the brake yet. You know, that's when I think it's actually using the regen. But, you know, you can turn it down in the settings. Now, I prefer it all the way up. And I do, you know, the thing is, like, in the context of when Teslas came out, like when they were designing these cars, when they were making all these options, they put in options. There's like the creep mode where, you know, with an automatic transmission, when you take your foot off the brake from a stop, the car starts slowly creeping forward. Electric cars have no reason to do that. So electric cars, when you take your foot off the brake by default, nothing happens. Like, you know, I mean, you might start falling down a hill or something, but, you know, if your hill hold's not on, but you know, electric cars, there is no automatic creeping forward when you stop braking. But Tesla, when they first were releasing the Model S and trying to get people to drive electric cars, they added this option called, you know, creep mode or something, which sounds hilarious and fits Elon well. But you know, and they added this mode to basically emulate how automatic transmissions drive so that people would be less disoriented when they first tried an electric car. And I think having the regen option be adjustable is that same kind of thing of like, okay, we're still kind of bringing people along from the gas world to the electric world, and we need you know, affordances for people to be comfortable with the transition. And so turning down regen as an option is one of those affordances. Now,
that's not the affordance we're talking about here, though. The affordance is people don't understand one pedal driving, so we have to make it that when you lift off the gas, the car doesn't start decelerating due to any kind of braking, right? That's the affordance to make people comfortable with it. But the thing we're talking about is okay, but what happens? What decelerates the car? And in a Tesla, it's like, well, if you turn regen on max and you lift up on the gas pedal, we will use regen to slow the car. And if you press the brake pedal, we use friction brakes to slow the car. And what they could have done, and what every other car manufacturer has done, and what I assume Tesla was doing, but apparently they're not, is how about for the affordance mode, you make the gas pedal work just like it does in a regular car, where you lift up and the car just coasts, right? You know, it slows down due to friction and air, but no braking is being applied. And then you make the brake pedal do a combination of regenerative and friction braking according to whatever weird-ass algorithm you have to do. Like the beginning of the brake pedal is all regen, and then as you keep pressing it and it needs more and more braking power, it starts to add the friction brakes. That would be perfectly understandable to internal combustion engine driver. They don't have to know what portion of the braking that is being put in response to their brake pedal action is regen and what portion is friction. And any decent car will blend those two together so you don't notice. The first round of electric cars from new manufacturers is like, oh, I can feel when it goes from regen to friction. But the more modern ones make that mostly transparent, probably because they're brake-by-wire at this point anyway. That's how I just assumed they all worked. But a car that only applies the friction brakes with the brake pedal is forcing you to do one pedal driving if you care at all about your battery life or your range, as they call it in cars rather than laptops, because you want to do regen. You want every ounce of that electricity that you use to make this multi-thousand pound car start rolling down the road. As you brake, you want that energy back as much as you can possibly get. Friction brakes throw that energy away as heat, right? Regen braking gives you some of it back. So it is insane to me that when you press the gas pedal in a Tesla, it does not do regen braking. It should, and presumably it will eventually.
You said gas pedal, and I think you mean brake pedal.
I keep saying gas pedal. Just substitute accelerator every time I say gas.
Well, no. In this case, I think you mean
the brake pedal.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
So, okay. So in this Mastodon thread, which is, I think, what John was referring to, you know, Quinn had some interesting thoughts. But then Technology Connections entered the chat, and that's our YouTuber that we all really enjoy, that does really genuinely fascinating and excellent YouTube videos about all manner of interesting engineering stuff. So Technology Connections, whose name I honestly don't know, wrote,
Alec.
I think you need to Alec. Okay, thank you. Alec writes, I think you need to remember that this only makes sense in the context of Teslas, which don't do blended braking. Most other EVs will still regenerate more when you use the brake pedal, no matter what the liftoff regen is set to. Tesla's not doing that is, to me, bonkers. Also, when the conditions are appropriate to coast, that is more efficient because you avoid the losses from charging and discharging. Alec continues, like, it truly boggles my mind that Tesla decided, no, the brake pedal only does the friction brakes, and you need to get used to what regen is like. And people actually defend this position. Hybrids have had blended braking since always, allowing people to coast when they want, regen when they need to slow down, and thus maximize efficiency without even thinking about it.
I'm assuming he's right because he usually knows what he's talking about, but
exactly, he
was my only source for this reality, and I just still find it hard to believe because it seems so bad, so inefficient. And now here, let me make my pitch for why one pedal driving is bad. I know people love it and it's fun and it's more relaxing to not have to go between gas and brake. These are the same people who think you shouldn't have a third pedal because how annoying is that? You got to keep pressing it. Obviously, but, right. So I get the appeal of one pedal driving, right? I think it is worse. Again, moving on my little safety, I think it's worse and also slightly less safe because here's the deal. Regen braking, forget about regen braking. The gas pedal that could actually apply all of the braking that your car is able to apply would be too annoying for anybody to use. What we're basically saying is you're pressing the gas pedal. When you lift up on the gas pedal, it's as if you were standing on the brakes. You can't drive that car. That's too much, right? That's not how any car works. No one wants it to work that way. Imagine you sneeze and your foot lifts off the gas pedal for a second, and it's as if you were applying maximum braking. You'd be causing accidents left and right. So what actually happens in these one-pedal driving, when it's set to one-pedal driving, is when you lift up on the gas pedal, it applies regen braking to a point. Even if it applies 100% of its possible regen braking, it doesn't apply the maximum braking that the car is capable of applying. And again, if there's some fantasy scenario where a car was able to do its full braking fully through regen, doesn't matter for the purpose of the story. But I think right now, cars that do regen braking, it's not the full braking of the car, right? So inevitably, there will be situations where you need more braking than you can get by lifting up on the gas pedal. You've lifted all the way up on the gas pedal. You're not even pressing the gas pedal anymore. You still need more braking. At that point, you need to A, realize this has happened, and B, switch over to the brake pedal. I don't like the idea that I'm doing one pedal driving and I'm in traffic and I'm coming up on a car and I feel like I'm going to be able to come to a stop behind that car by lifting up on the gas pedal and it will be fine. And I lift up on the gas pedal and I just realize when I hit the end of the travel that that's actually not enough braking. At that point, at the last second, I need to go to the brake pedal and apply a little bit more braking. I'd feel much better about knowing I'm going to need to come to a stop here. Let me stop being in the accelerator mode and put my foot over on the brake pedal and modulate the brake pedal to come to a nice stop where I intend or slow to the degree that I intend. I don't like the idea that the whole idea of like one pedal driving, you can't drive with one pedal because sometimes you always need more braking. And in fact, the times when you might need more braking are the most biggest emergency situations. And if you get in the mindset that I just drive with my right foot on the one pedal, it's one pedal driving. You have to snap out of that at the right moment to go over to the brake pedal. It seems to me to be a more dangerous and more complicated situation than the much simpler one of when I'm in go mode, I use the go pedal. And when I'm in no-go mode, I use the no-go pedal. It's very clear what mode you're in. And especially in situations where you're like, I've been decelerating for hundreds of feet. The whole time my foot has been on the brake pedal, pressing it to varying degrees. I'm already in no-go mode. I'm in the slowing down mode. And if something unexpected happens during the slowing down thing, your foot's already in the right spot, right?
Having driven an electric car with the behavior you think is the worst for many, many years now.
It's not the worst. I just think it's slightly less safe.
Well, I can tell you that. And so obviously, like, I had a bit of context in the sense that the car I had before the Model S was the M5. And the M5, I had, you know, little flappy paddle shifters. And I would, being a stick driver before, I would downshift a lot to slow down. Like, that was my main method of slowing down, was downshifting. And so, and it had that giant engine, and so it had a lot of engine suction also whenever you decelerate. And so it felt not that different going from that with all that engine suction and all the downshifting to the Tesla with its aggressive regen. It actually felt very similar. And so,
but were you using your engine as your main braking thing so you could do one pedal driving the M5? Because I know we've talked about this in the past, but I would suggest that in most cars, maybe not in the M5, but in most cars, brake pads are cheaper than clutches.
Not when you're leasing. So...
That's anyway, a good point. No, I am an engine braking apologist, even though I know
I do engine braking too, but I would never use it as a way to do one pedal driving, so I don't have to use the brakes.
Well, regardless, so I'm saying, like, when I came to the Tesla, like, it felt natural to have aggressive regen, and I just got used to it very, very quickly. And I never...
The getting used to it is the dangerous part, though, because you get into the mode where, like, I just need this one pedal to drive the car. That's it.
No, but I think the... Your concern that you would rely 100% on the gas pedal is, I think, unfounded. There was never a time when I felt like I was using the gas pedal exclusively, because the engine braking, or rather the regen provided by the gas pedal by letting off of it, would usually not be enough to bring the car to a complete stop in most circumstances.
I'm not even talking about the last 2 seconds of the complete stop. I'm like, and you're right that, like I said, I didn't want to characterize what the regen is, like what percentage of the full power of the braking is available to regen. But my assumption is that the percentage of braking power that a car possesses that will be possible by regen will just increase with time. Because for efficiency purposes, because you want actually you want regen to be extremely powerful. You want that energy back. So the fact that you can't come to a complete stop, or that it's only, 20% of the full braking power of the car, that may be an accident of history today. I feel like in a golf cart, for example, you can come to a complete stop because they go 5 miles an hour or whatever.
Well, the other trick, though, that might keep this from ever becoming too much stronger than it is today, is that you can't always take the regen power. So if the batteries are too full, for instance, like if you're about to go on a really long trip and you charge to 100%, you don't have regen for the first few miles of the trip.
You just put that power right back in the grid and the other cars get it.
And there's
your odometer goes backwards when you do that.
Yeah. And there's also like different thermal conditions that the battery might be in.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's lots of physics-based reasons why regen is not 100% of the power of the car. I just said, like, the trend is going to be the more regen power possible. And this whole thing of the variability of, like, sometimes you can't take it and so forth argues even more for there should be a go pedal and a stop pedal. And what the hell that stop pedal is doing depends on all sorts of variables that you don't care about. How much power can I regen? How much power am I able to regen? How charged is my battery? What temperature is it? Like, all, but you don't care because it's entirely seamless. If the stop pedal does some combination of crap to slow your car down in a way that responds linearly to you pressing it. It's like there's a braking curve and the brake pedal implements that. And there's a going curve and the go pedal implements that. And it's simple and they have their jobs and the car manufacturers are free to vary all of that within. Whereas with quote unquote one pedal driving, I feel like you're building bad habits and it's just going to change too much from car to car based on all the regen stuff, unless you're going to start adding friction brakes as you lift up the gas pedal, which I suppose they could. But like I said, I don't think that's viable because I don't think you want 100% braking when you lift off the gas.
I don't know. I have not spent a lot of time in Teslas, but I've spent a fair bit, especially as someone who's never owned one. And I think there's aspects of what both of you are saying that are true. In my experience, I don't personally see why one pedal driving is so amazing as so many EV drivers seem to think, but maybe that's my own ignorance talking. But I pretty reasonably quickly acclimated to regenerative braking and kind of got used to basically one pedal driving. And I don't think it's too different than like going between a three pedal car where the clutch catch is really low, and then immediately after driving that, jumping into a three pedal car where the clutch catch is really high. And so you just have to reacclimate yourself. And within the span of a few driving miles, usually you've got yourself reacclimated and it's fine. And yeah. I feel like my experience with one pedal driving was basically like that. Now, I understand your argument, John, that maybe you could make an argument that it's not as safe, but ultimately for anyone that's been driving for any amount of time, unless you learn to drive on a one pedal car, which that time is happening and will happen, unless you're learning to drive on a car like that, your natural reaction from the past 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years of driving is to reach for that brake when there's an emergency. You're not even going to think about it. And so I don't think that we're like reprogramming our brains for emergency evasion. Yeah, we are maybe reprogramming our brains.
It's not so much the programming is that your foot would already be on the brake. So you don't pay the travel cost, right? Because in non-one pedal driving, you'd already be riding the brake to some degree at the point when the emergency occurs. Whereas with one pedal driving, you're not even on the brake yet because you're doing the one pedal drive thing and the emergency occurs, you have to pay the cost to switch. There's always going to be situations where you'd be surprised and you have to hit the brake, right? But there's so many situations where normally you would be on the brake. I think this whole thing of like getting used to it and not being a big deal relies on the current strength of regen braking, which is, again, some small portion of the total braking power of the car. If regen gets more powerful and more of the full braking power of the car is done by regen, and that, you know, accumulates to the one pedal, it will be, because I think in this situation, you're saying like, it's you're one pedal driving, but really you're one pedal drive for a little bit, but you always have to eventually go onto the brake. So it's really just like a slight delay in what would have normally been a switch to the brake. But if regen becomes more powerful, more and more situations, you never need to leave the gas. And that's where I feel like you're building the habit that you feel like I can drive this entire car with the gas, which is not true, although you're building that habit. Like, imagine if you didn't need to use the brake pedal except in emergencies, which is not true in any regen braking car now. But if that was true and people learned on that, they wouldn't have the habit to go over to the brake in an emergency and it would be much less safe, right? And then, you know, with the current cars where you're leaving and going over to the brake a little bit later than you would, you're probably fine. It's probably not that big of a deal, but I feel like the benefit is there. I see it, which is the same benefit as not having a third pedal. I don't want to keep moving my foot back and forth. It's annoying. And stop and go traffic, it's annoying to do that. It's more comfortable in stop and go traffic to not have to move my foot back and forth, right? That's the argument. That's why people find it appealing. I just feel like, you know, a brake pedal and gas pedal is not too much to ask until we get self-driving.
All right, titles.
That's a good end. Let's see.
I think you're wrong about this, John, but that's all right.
You are.
If I'm wrong about it, it's only because regen braking is so weak in cars now that it's not that big a deal. It's just like, oh, it's nice to have, but, you know, it's not preventing me from going over to the brake.
All right, here we go.
But I'm totally with technology connections guy on the Tesla model of only doing friction brakes with the brake pedal is so dumb.
It felt really natural.
But because they didn't know how to do blended braking. So like, well, we just don't solve that problem. We'll make people do one pedal, but it's so bad for efficiency. Like that's what Quinn was on about. Like, you would not want to go on a long trip with that because you basically are forced to do maximum regen one pedal driving or take a hit in range.
I mean, I went on lots of long trips. I drove tens of thousands of miles that way. I can tell you it's fine.
No, Quinn's point was that you should never have
regen
selectables.
On max.
Yeah, always, yeah. always, no matter
because
what.
You're not getting the efficiency. In a Tesla, you're not getting the efficiency. In a sane car, there'd be no difference in efficiency because, like, all you're saying, in a sane car, your efficiency is just determined by how you go and stop. Like, how that's it. It doesn't matter how you go and stop. It's just like, how frequently do you go? How fast do you go? How much do you stop? But in a Tesla, if you don't have regen on, you don't get any regen. It's like, well, I should not be getting regen when I'm braking. And Tesla says, no, the only way you're going to get that is maximum regen, one pedal driving mode. And they're two separate concerns. One is an interface issue and one is a, please give me my energy back when my car slows down.
No, I think, again, I don't have barely any experience with this, but on paper, I think blended braking is the right or answer by a mile.
That's what everybody does.
Oh, yeah.
Except for Tesla. I cannot believe that.
I agree. Tesla Full Kindles is a good title. Only Hit by One Plow is a good title.
I like the plow better than the Kindles only because I don't want all the Tesla people to see the title and then start sending us crap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's better to leave Tesla out of the title.
Oh, you don't think we're going to get all the feedback from that after show? Oh my God, I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, but at least like most of the
trolls haven't used the brake on my
far.
Tesla in 5 years and I'm fine.
I mean, I never had to
remove the
brake
pedal from my Tesla. I removed the brake pedal from my Tesla. I don't even need it. The car stops itself.
Well, you
no,
don't
but
even
the thing
need
is,
a
because,
steering wheel.
Because the regen doesn't stop the car all the way, you end up still using the brake pedal, so you never get out of the habit of using the brake pedal.
I know. It's only because of the relative weakness of regen. right
now. Let it go, boys. Let it go. I would like to go to bed tonight. All right. Only Hit by One Plow is good. Silly Rich Person TV is bad.
Driven by a Little Old Man.
That is pretty good, but it's a bit insulting. But I did think that
I
was
a little old lady who just drove into her church on Sundays. That's it. It's in perfect condition.
I mean, it has sat parked for a good
portion of its
life. It's
a garage queen. Yeah.
Well, no, it's not a garage queen. It's a parking lot queen.
Yeah, it's a fairy parking lot.
It's a fairy parking lot queen does not sound as good to the buyer.
I'm saying.
That's marking it by the plow.
Yeah, it's had undriven with grass growing under it for months.
Yeah. It got deer ticks in the weir wells.
I actually am genuinely surprised that thing didn't ever, like, deplete its battery to the point that it wouldn't move. You know, like, leave
it's
it
a big battery.
I know, but
it manages itself really well. Like,
that's,
you know,
what I'm saying. I'm actually complimenting
it. It
would
lose less than 1% per day, like it, just sitting there. It was great. I mean, if this car still fit my needs and wasn't, you know, a giant MAGA hat on wheels right now, I would totally keep it. Like, I like a lot about it, but, you know, my priorities and likes have shifted right now.
I actually am proud of you, Marco, because I think you've only whined about pumping gas once.
I did it today. I mean, I had to do it a
look
lot.
Look at you. But... look at you. I'm so proud.
The whine of Yazra has to go to New Jersey and make someone else do it.
I did that. I had to get gas in New Jersey, and it was awful.
It's no good. Yeah.
Like, once you figure out how to turn left.
But the prices are so good.
Yeah. The prices are better upstate.
The gasoline is just in the air. You can smell it.
Yeah, right. That's true. You're smelling lots of things in New Jersey.
No. Everything is legal there. I can do Only Hit by One Plow.
I think the Only Hit by One Plow. I think that's the funniest car title. I do like the I Just Bought a Tailgate TV, but it kind of ruins the joke. I also like Chi Chargers Are Not Coasters.
I think I like the Plow one more than the Chi one, but I also like that one as well.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Maximum Regen is a good title, but it's not as funny as the Plow one. I think Plow is it.
No, right. Let's just go with it.
Cool.
All right. So before we cut off the live listeners, when are we live next? Let me look at a calendar.
In like a week and a half, right?
I plan my summer vacation today, but we don't have to schedule that now.
Oh my gosh, you already did summer? No, that means I'm behind.
So January 18th is our next live show?
I think that's right.
I almost couldn't get the dates on my house. It was a big scramble today.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God, don't tell me that. Oh, no. I don't like this at all.
Everyone is after the holidays. Everyone's like, oh, New Year, I better do it. I wanted to do it before the New Year, but, you know, it's multiple people involved there.
Yeah. All right, I'm actually going to hit save in the robot here.
It's the next 18th. Recording on the 18th?
Yep.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Normal time, normal day.
Yep. In theory. Until
do you know the reference, same bat time, same bat channel? Was that the
yes. Bam! Pow!
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've heard people say it, but I don't know what it's from. I assume old Batman cartoons or something?
Yeah, the 60s Batman live action television series at the end, they would say, tune in next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.
Cool.
Because kids used to have to watch TV shows on a particular channel at a particular time.
Yeah, it was hard.
It was someone was doing an interview with the Last of Us video game has a TV series coming out on HBO, and they were doing an interview with the two lead roles. It's the Mandalorian guy is the lead role. What's his name?
I know who you're thinking of. I don't remember his name. Anyway, shoot.
That guy. The chat room have in a second. He's the Last of Us. I don't know if you played the game or saw Tiff play it.
Yeah,
it's an older man and a young girl, right? So the Mandalorian actor is a man. He's in the interview and he's being interviewed with his co-star, this young girl. And the interviewer is asking them fun questions. It's like, you know, what kind of TV reruns do you enjoy watching? And the lead actor guy talks about some like Golden Girls reruns or whatever. And they ask the girl and she says, what's a rerun?
Oh, Jesus.
And everyone crumbles
to dust.
It's a good
question, right? I mean,
that ain't good at all.
Pedro Pascal. Thank you, Chuck. What's a rerun? Oh, yeah. He was a character on What's Happening.
I am not here for this. Goodness.
I mean, it makes sense, though. Like, my kid doesn't know what a rerun is because he doesn't know what things airing means. Like, that's not a thing. There are no time slots for the things that he watches.
He learned about live TV from football, though, right?
A little bit, yeah. The football, it's funny, homework. Like, we're going through some Seinfeld with him now, and he's really enjoying it, actually. It's by his request. And
it does other things!
And we...
Get to that episode. That's great.
Yeah. But like we always have to like pause and explain Like so many,
all the technology.
So yeah, many things. Yeah, yeah.
Or what's just a VHS tape? What do they need to be rewound? Where are they returning them to? Why do they have them? What's
right,
the point?
Yeah. This entire plotline is solved by cell phones. Like, there's just so many.
Yeah.
it's pretty
I think
fun.
They do have cell phones in the show eventually. Like, what is that box he's holding? That's a cell phone.
Yeah, right.
that's a car phone. You can only use it in your car.
Yep.
He uses the antenna attached to your car.
When,
you could tell it was a fancy limousine when it had the car antenna on the back of it, the car phone antenna.
Yeah, my dad, there was a call waiting joke in the last episode, and it's like,
oh,
well,
nice,
gonna get that.
Nice.
Like that whole bit's out. You know,
my dad, when he bought the Saturn that I ended up, driving when I was in high school and college, he put in a car phone mount. You know, so you would slot your cell phone into the car phone, and by the time I had gotten the car, that particular phone was useless and we didn't have it anymore, but he never bothered taking the mount in the car out of the car. But I discovered, I don't know if it was on purpose by accident, but one way or another, I discovered that the cell phone car mount was the perfect mount for an Altoids tin. And I was a big Altoids fan at the time. And so what I ended up doing was slotting my Altoids tin right where the cell phone used to go. And it was perfect. It was amazing. They were always right on hand. It was great.
Unfortunately, the chat room may have just make a statement, change the title, because Jeremy Renner was recently hit by a snowplow. This is a real thing.
Oh, shoot. That's right.
We can't really use only hit by one.
No.
Even though it's not what we mean, how many people even know that your car was hit by a plow requires past knowledge?
No, you're right.
No,
that's
Jeremy Renner.
We can't do that.
I didn't. I saw that thing and I felt bad, but I'm like, did they mean
this?
Jeremy Renner, the Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
You
we still shouldn't do it, but I don't know this person.
No. That's fair. That's not.
Especially with the Ken Block thing. So Ken Block died from a snowmobile flipping over on him, which is terrible. But then it was like Jeremy Renner, and it showed a picture of him in the hospital. I'm like, oh, he's grievously injured, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, in a snowplow accident. I'm like, was he driving the plow?
I don't even know what happened.
I still don't know the details. But anyway, that kills our title.
All right. So what do you think?
That's thank you. Thank you, chat room. I am all in on Tesla Kindles. Annoying people be banned.
I like Driven by a Little Old Man, but whatever.
I'm like Tesla Kindles.
What if Tesla Kindles wasn't even in the show? What is that?
Yeah,
it was in the show.
Saying use the Tesla as packing material for Kindles or whatever, but the Tesla full of Kindles was not a phrase that anybody said.
I said it. Well, I said that stuff full of Kindles or something like that. Like it was basically something I said.
All right. No, so I think it's there. I think it would be fine. However, I'm worried that portion of the show is going to get cut, because that was kind of when we went off on that tangent that I directed.
No, I was going to shorten it. I was going to we talk about like selling the Tesla. We talk about cars and bids, and some of that we should probably keep, because like we refer back. So it's like, yeah, some of that we need to keep. But I was going to shorten it down.
I like can't make the micro enough about micro LED.
No, I think a Tesla
power vacuum.
She charges her not coasters.
No, I like. I still like Driven by a Little Old Man, although that does ruin the joke. Actually, what else did you guys say? What other than the coasters? What were the other ones?
Power vacuum. Can't make the micro enough.
Can't make the micro enough is pretty good. I like that one. And that
it's
was about
okay.
TVs.
Okay, I mean, I think I'd rather do almost any of the other like top handful. Let's just do Tesla full of Kindles.
All right, we'll leave it there. But let's assume that for some reason it gets cut or it's not said. Is there a backup that we want to agree on?
Well, he's not gonna.
I'm okay with
the
title.
Yeah, I like Driven by a Little Old Man. That's fine.
All right, so we'll use. I'm gonna put that at the top of the show notes, Marco, just so we don't lose it.
Yeah.
But let's go with Tesla full of Kindles, unless you feel like for some reason it doesn't work or you know what was said was.
Yeah,
too
I'll
far
see
away.
What ends up in the edit and.
All right. No, thank you, chat room. No joke.
Yeah, thanks.
That would have been very uncomfortable, and I would have been real embarrassed. So thank you.
We would have had to explain over and over again that Marco's car was hit by a snowplow. And that Marco doesn't know who Jeremy Renner is.
I still don't.
Let alone know anything about him being hit by a snowplow.
All right. Goodbye, live people. We'll talk to you on the 18th.
Bye, live people. See you sometime soon. All right.